Okay.
Call to order the House Committee on Environment and Water.
And I'd like to call to order the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources.
Great. We are having a joint committee today in the interest of efficient operations here in the state legislature, and pleasure to meet with our counterparts in the Senate. We're going to begin today with, it'll be an informational meeting the entire time. Members know that. There will be no formal action. We're going to get updates on a number of different items, and we're going to begin with a informational meeting on the bottle bill. And I'm going to ask Melissa Brown and anyone who she brings up from, I don't know if it's the Kiva, the Kiva.
Kiva.
Kiva?
Yes.
Yeah.
Carl.
And Carl.
I'm Carl Nash. I'm the sole representative.
All right. Mr. Nash, come on up and tell us about your experience with the bottle bill.
Okay.
Why don't you have a seat? I think any of the mics will work.
Okay.
That looks good. And go ahead and introduce yourself for the record. And we have probably about 10 minutes here, so
okay.
A little time for presentation and then Q&A.
Cool. So my name is Carl Nash, and I'm the general manager of the Kiva. The Kiva is a grocery store in downtown Eugene. And Melissa Brown is the owner. She's unable to be here today. And, good afternoon. Thanks for letting me come here to speak to you about our experiences with the bottle bill. I'm mostly here today to talk about some problems that we've run into as we're trying to comply with the bottle bill. We wrote a letter kind of outlining some of the financial burdens it had put on us, which is what got us invited to speak here today. And I'll just go ahead and start by reading this written testimony I have.
And, I notice it's fairly long.
Sure.
Your best to summarize as you go, and we'll take a look at the at the letter that you've provided.
Cool. So,
and thanks for preparing this, by the way.
No problem at all.
Helpful.
Okay, so I'm sure you're aware of the particulars of the bottle bill, and as a store that has 5,300 square feet of retail space, we fall into the larger category of stores. We don't consider ourselves a large grocery store, but with the changes to the bottle bill, we have to accept any returns that come in regardless of whether or not we sell them. We have experienced that. We have experienced a substantial increase in the number of returns coming to our store. As far as a financial impact, it's roughly 4 hours a day of increased labor receiving and sorting the bottles, roughly $13,000 annually in payroll expenditure as a direct result of this increase in bottle returns to our store. Then the other issue that we've noticed too, previous to the bottle bill, changes to the bottle bill, when you only had to accept the returns that you sold, the Kiva has never sold canned domestic beer. We've never sold malt liquor, and those are the majority of the returns that are coming in. So we didn't really experience the kind of volumes that we're experiencing now. And we've noticed that in addition to the financial impact, there's been quite a bunch of other problems that have come along with this. In the last 10 years before the changes to the bottle bill, we've never had to ban a bottle returner from our property. We've never had a problem with people bringing in returns before. And I don't want to sound like we're complaining or saying that people that bring bottles in are bad people or they do anything wrong. But in the last 4 months, we've had to ban 9 people from our property that were bottle returners, visibly intoxicated, shoplifting, bringing in needles in the returns, urinating in our parking lot, harassing customers in the parking lot. And we feel that this is a direct, it's a burden placed on us because we don't have the payroll to have a security guard on staff. We don't have an outside place for bottle collection, so it has to, bottle returns have to take place within the store proper. And those are the main issues we've dealt with, is both the financial impact and also being placed in a position to deal, we may have to soon get a security guard and have them on staff at all times because of this issue. So I'd be welcome to, answer any questions that you guys have for me.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Nash. Is this your first time testifying at the Oregon Legislature? Well, you've done very well. Summarize the letter nicely, and we'll see if there are questions. Great. Well, I know I will read with interest what's here. I think one of the recommendations in the letter is that we might consider changing that distinction between small stores and large stores from 5,000 square feet to 10,000 square feet. Of course, that would help you out.
Yeah.
Might be, you know, then we'd have somebody who would come along that's at 10,100 square feet who says, why 10,000? But
obviously, there has to be a cutoff point at some at some place. We feel most of the larger stores are way over 10,000 square feet. I mean, there's many stores that have backstock space larger than our whole retail, you know, retail space. And with 500 square feet of backstock, when we have a you know, a shed full of returns, that's actually taking up about as much space as we have to receive pallets. So, you know, I understand that you can't make it, you know, exceptions on a case-by-case basis, but we at least wanted to present the fact that we feel like a fair amount of burden is being placed on us financially in terms of impeding our ability to receive freight and also just everything else that we're having to deal with. So thanks for letting us come and present those issues.
Great. Yep. Senator Bookless.
Yeah, thank you. Just a quick question. Look, your sales, you sell mostly microbrews in there, and you said you didn't take back beer cans, so on and so forth. Do you sell canned products or you just sell bottled products?
We don't, yeah, we don't sell any cans at all. It's all bottles. So previously, you know, we didn't, you didn't have to take back brands that you didn't sell, so we didn't sell any domestic cans.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yep,
follow up. So then, you know, I mean, another delineation, you know, we talked about size as a possible delineation. Another delineation could be product type, for example, cans, bottles, plastic bottles.
Oh, very much so, yeah. Right. I mean, that was our primary, there was a reason why we weren't carrying these products because, I don't know if you're familiar with Eugene, but it's a college town, obviously, and somebody who wants to collect returns can go around the frat houses and just basically bag up bags of cans and bring them in. And people do, you know, bring in their full allotment every single day over and over.
Mr. I think you're saying they consume a lot of beer in that college.
Yeah. Who knew? Thanks very much for your testimony today. Really appreciate you being here and send our regards and thanks to Ms. Brown as well for her interest in this and continued communication with me and I suspect other members of the committee. This, I hope, as we'll perhaps get a sense from the next two folks to testify on the bottle bill, I think this is a subject to which we may return with legislation in 2011 or if not 2011, perhaps 2013, but there may be opportunities to try to deal with the particular issue that your store and stores like it may face. So continue to be in touch.
Yeah, cool. Okay. Thank you
great.
So much.
Thanks. And let's have Tom Irwin and John Anderson. Why don't you come up together in the interest of time? And Tom, you're on the agenda first. Do you want to kick us off? And I know it's I'd be interested in hearing where we stand on the redemption center process. Both of you have important roles to play there. Also interested in finding out what the experience has been under a year plus of water bottles. So.
Oh, okay. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, Chair Cannon, and Chair Haas, and the members of the committee. For the record, I'm Tom Irwin. I'm the Government Affairs Director with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. The Oregon Liquor Control Commission enforces the bottle bill, which is why I'm here. I'm going to be fairly brief, hopefully, but just to give you a little bit of background, after House Bill 2184 passed in the 2007 session, I have my dates wrong already, I believe that was the case. Anyway, when we expanded to the bottle bill and it took effect January 1st of 2009, one of the other things we took a look at is existing rules that we had on redemption centers. Redemption centers have always been part of the bottle bill, but to our knowledge, we've never actually gotten an application, a formal application, at least with the employees that are at the OLCC currently. Nobody can remember has ever seen a formal redemption center application. So we felt like we needed to look at the rules that did exist, kind of examine them, and pull in a group of stakeholders to help us perhaps expand those rules in looking at redemption center applications coming forward to us. And we did so back a year ago, both on April 10th and 23rd of 2009, we held advisory committee meetings and had stakeholders give us the information that they thought was pertinent for us to develop those rules. As a part of that, we looked at the days and hours of operation. We looked at parking and access. We looked at local ordinance and zoning requirements. We looked at the payment method and redemption issues themselves. We looked at the daily cap per person that currently exists to see whether or not we wanted to expand that or change that at all. We looked at one of the most important issues, obviously, in terms of convenience, is the distance that a new redemption center, when it was sited, was going to be from the dealers that it served. And we looked at ongoing customer service issues, data collection, cleanliness and sanitation, and just the whole issue of being flexible when we looked at these applications. As a result of that, we did amend some rules, and we did put into place some requirements on regarding information on the caps, the payment methods, the projected volumes, and how consumers will be notified about pertinent redemption center information, the location, the services, the service hours, etc. And we also took a look a little bit at the cleanliness concerns and set some standards for redemption center operators. In the future, we would also like to take a look at some information and put it in our rules regarding data collection. We currently don't have that, in part because it's one of those issues of you don't know what you don't know. We don't have any data yet to look at and examine, so we're not quite sure what it is we want to capture. But it is part of the order that we have. I'm jumping ahead here. The next process was actually having some redemption center applications come forward to us. Currently, we have a history where we have three. One which was withdrawn because there were some issues regarding the local government and zoning issues, although I think that's correct or fair to say, John, in the Gresham area. A subsequent one came in from the Wood Village area. It was accepted by the commission, and an order was put into place. So we're waiting for that to come online. And John Anderson is here to talk about that a little further and give you more information about where that stands. And then a third application recently came in for the Oregon City area. So it's under consideration right now and is going through that particular process. From the redemption center standpoint, that's pretty much it at this point. And I don't know if you want me to then come back to the expansion of the bottle bill later or how you want to handle that,
Chair
Cannon.
Let's stick with redemption centers now, and maybe we'll have some back and forth in this conversation. So stick around,
sure.
Tom. And John, do you want to tell us where you're at on redemption centers?
Sure. For the record, my name is John Anderson. I'm president of OBRC, Oregon Beverage Recycling Cooperative. I thank you for the opportunity to talk about this. So we are, Tom's done a great job of kind of laying out the historical work that we've done. But I do want to say that the OLCC has done a great job in our estimation from what we've seen in developing what I think are some tough questions for us to answer as we've gone through the process and put together some pretty significant questions that we need to answer back to them in terms of consumer return patterns and so forth as we move together. So I want to compliment Tom and his group there for the work that they've done. I think they've done a good job in shepherding this, which is new for all of us, including them, I know. So Tom's correct. We had submitted an application for a site in Gresham that ultimately we ran into some roadblocks from a zoning standpoint.
And John, I think it might be helpful, possibly for members of the committee or members of the audience, to explain in a little more detail what a redemption center is. So as people hear these words, they have some picture in their mind of what we're talking about here.
Okay, well, a redemption center, essentially under Oregon statute, is a replacement return mechanism for the existing return to grocery system. And essentially, as our application was submitted, we have taken a group of participating retailers, as I think is defined in the application, and found a location that we believe to provide a convenience to the surrounding consumers, and put together a model for consumers to use our redemption center in lieu of one of these participating grocery retailers for a return of all of their bottle bill containers. And I see you're receiving a little pamphlet. I didn't bring any written testimony, and I don't have a lot to hand out, but I have a little bit. one piece there you're getting, which is a piece that we would be putting together, or we are putting together for the Wood Village specific site. So you can see from that, we're trying to develop a retail concept that consumers will find friendly and certainly view as convenient. And you can see from there that we've talked about the number of different ways that a consumer can return containers through our redemption center. And we can certainly talk more about that if you have any questions. But essentially, that's the redemption center model in our minds, a replacement for a defined set of participating grocery stores. So we went, we looked at Gresham, we ended up taking the application back because of the zoning issues, but we found what we think is a match in terms of location as well as zoning regulations in Wood Village. And so that's one of the two applications that we've submitted, and it's the one application that has gone before the OLCC commissioners and been approved. The second application is for that we've submitted is a site in Oregon City, and we have submitted the application. I believe we're on the agenda for a mid-June review by the OLCC commissioners, and the concept is very similar. We've listed a group of participating grocers that would be serviced by the Redemption Center. We've, in the application, talked about parking, hours of service, maximum returns per day, how the consumer would be paid. Generally, I think all the good questions that consumers would have related to how they will operate with a redemption center versus with their grocery retailer. So that's the second one that we've submitted. And at this point, it's our desire to open both of these sites and operate them over the next year, more or less, but certainly up until the beginning of the 2011 session, and essentially collect data on consumer response, consumer acceptance, which will be somewhat, I think, a little more subjective in terms of the feedback we get, but also collect objective data in terms of returns. Because the co-op is servicing the participating grocery retailers today in terms of picking up and processing the empties they collect, as well as any retailers in the surrounding area who may not be participating, we'll be able to look at the data on where the returns were going prior to opening the redemption center and compare it to where the returns end up going after we've opened the redemption center. And our hope is that we see as many or more returns going to the redemption center as we see today going to the participating grocery retailers.
Great. See if there are any questions on the redemption center. Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Chair. A couple of questions, specifically for John. How do you plan to make money at it? Because if it doesn't break even, obviously you're not the government. That's the first question. And the following question is, have you done any research on returnee characteristics? I mean, do the people come back normally to a grocery store, return the cans, put the money in their pocket and go on, or they go spend it in the grocery store? And, of course, the reason I ask that is the redemption center is not exactly going to walk-in. So what's your market analysis and what's your rate of return? How you going to pay for it?
Okay, well, those are good questions. For, on the first question, how will we make money? Well, in a way, I guess we are the government. We are not. This is not a for-profit venture. In fact, it will be paid for by the industry with no possibility for any return on that. So it's a recognition by both grocery retailers and beverage distributors that the current system of returns needs some improvement. And so the commitment that we have across the industry, generally speaking, is that the beverage distributors and the grocers, the participating grocers, will fund the system. And we anticipate, upon full rollout, which we think to be 90 to 100 of these, that will be somewhere in the range of $16 to $18 million a year that the industry will spend to fund these centers. So the reason why there hasn't been any in 39 years or 40 years, however long the bottle bill has been around, is because there is no funding mechanism in place to, there's no mechanism to make money on the redemption centers. But this model that we've put together really looks at it in a different way, provides the funding because it's necessary in our estimation for a successful bottle bill, but there would be no profit. And then your second question on what are consumer return patterns and what do we expect to see in terms of a replacement for the system at the grocery store versus what we're doing. We've looked at that some. It's difficult to get a large cross-section of return data that works in the areas I think that we've been looking at. I think consumers view it in many different ways, and there's many types of returners. There's returners who bring back just a couple at a time. They maybe bring back a six-pack. There's people that save them up in the garage and bring back a truckload. There's people that collect them from curbside bins and bring back a truckload. There's folks who bring back returns once a month. I think we just have a variety of different patterns, but part of the model that we've developed that we'll be testing is being used in Maine today, Maine the state, and we have a lot of data from their experience in how consumer returns have occurred, and we're hoping that at least in large part we see that similar returns here in Oregon, because we've based our concept in many ways on what they have done. So did that answer your question?
Follow up, Senator Bookus.
No, I'm a businessman, so it didn't answer it.
Follow up. Back to the rate of return and loss. Could you kind of outline, because I also noticed in here you're only going to take 50 cans back, so half of what you said there doesn't apply, because there are no more than 50 cans. So can you give the committee maybe an idea of, I mean, how many cans and bottles do we sell? So what's that value? Because it's, you know, so much for bottle, so much for can, versus how many are returned in the state?
I can't go that broad with you, but maybe I can speak to the 50 that you've seen on the flyer. I think what that refers to, if I had an overhead, I could pop it up and look at it exactly myself. But of the three ways that we're going to give consumers in terms of choice to return containers,
it's magic.
I'm going to make sure I'm right here.
Yeah,
so the hand count, the one you saw there, hand count, in our redemption center model, we will provide hand counts for consumers. One of the complaints we heard today in large scale at large grocery retailers is that consumers that have just a few containers are unable to have a store clerk count those by hand. They have to put them through a reverse vending machine, and if the machine's full or broken down, they wait for that. So one of the things that we intend on doing in our model is providing hand count service up to 50 containers. In other words, we don't want somebody to come in with a pickup truck and ask us to go through that and count it. So that's the model there. But in terms of the self-serve, you can see the three ways to redeem. The second one there, the self-serve is more the traditional reverse vending machine model where you can put containers through. And we will have a limit of sorts. Our desire, ultimate desire, is to have no limit per day. We have a mechanism where we think we can take very large quantities of containers and get them processed, unlike the grocery stores do today. We would just like to test a model where we're not put on demand out of the gate for pickup trucks. It's not a, that's a challenge, I think, for any environment, and it ends up, I think, impacting the system for other users as well. So we're not hung up on a limit per day, where I think the grocery stores are somewhat tied with their resources to that 144. We think we can do very large quantities. We would just like to work with folks that have large quantities to steer them in the right direction.
Chair Hess, and then Representative Smith.
Thank you. So, as I understand it, you'll be able to just drop your bottles off, and you'll count up later, and so that should only take a few seconds, right?
Seconds, we hope.
Yes.
Yeah. No, and that's the. I guess I should have done a little better job of presenting this, but that's the first way on the card you receive, the easy drop system, and we really think that's what will make this system unique and we think consumers will love. And we know we're up against certainly a tradition of going to the grocery retailer to return containers. And so when we set out to put this model together, we knew we had to do something that added convenience that they don't have, that consumers don't have today. And the idea of being able to take a bag back that we will count for you and apply a credit to your account, we think adds a tremendous amount of convenience. And we've talked to a lot of Oregonians about this. Now we've had about 2 years worth of time to talk about the system, and we've had very favorable response with anybody that we've gone through the system and talked with them about.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Can you give to us sort of the clearest rendition of our standards for success, how you will measure sort of accomplishment towards your objectives?
Yeah, boy, I had that.
Do you have that? Are you looking for that? Well, let me
do my best. I think there's a few specific metrics that we'll look at if you want to hear these. First of all, we want to see that we have not simply shifted returns from the participating retailers, participating in the redemption center, who would no longer be taking containers back. We want to see that we've not simply shifted the returns that were otherwise going to those large retailers to perhaps surrounding small retailers. So the model, because they're participating retailers, since there are participating retailers, there are also non-participating retailers that would be in the general proximity of these two, Wood Village or Oregon City. So the first metric I would say is verifying that we're not simply shifting the large return store volume from those locations to small retailers.
How are we going to count that? I mean, you need to go ask the small retailers, or what data do we have to let us know?
Well, we have the actual return data because the co-op is picking up at all of these locations mm-hmm. today. We're going to over 3,000 locations statewide. If you're any store and you're getting returns back through the bottle bill system, we are picking you up. Mm-hmm. So we have all the data. Certainly right. In the areas of Wood Village and Oregon City, we have 20-some years of data because we still have the container recovery data. So we'll have great, as good as you could get, really, data before and after to look at whether that pattern shifted. So I think that's really the first metric. The second metric is really looking to see whether we've taken the large store volume that from the participating retailer and moved it to other surrounding large stores. So as a consumer, you may decide you don't like the redemption center, but you're not going to go to a 7-Eleven to return your containers, and there's a limit on the amount you can take there today. So maybe you'll go to another large grocery retailer that's, say, 3 miles away. So we have all of that data as well. We want to make sure that we're not driving the returns to one large retailer to other surrounding large retailers. And that's really the second one. And I would say the third, which I talked about a little bit, but we've got quite a bit of consumer survey data that we intend on continuing to work with the consumers in the areas, in both the grocery store, at the grocery store after we've established the redemption center, and at the redemption center, collecting their response to how they view the new system, and putting that together. And Tom's given me here some in the ruling, in OLCC's ruling, they've put together a pretty stringent standard of data that we need to come back and present to them. And Tom, you can probably talk about that.
Well, no, it's just part of the order that the commissioner signed.
Yeah, so
make it available.
Hey, go ahead.
So what you haven't mentioned, John, is so you mentioned the possibility that consumers would shift their habits, and instead of going to the redemption center, they can't go to their grocery store where they're used to returning, and they don't instead of going to the redemption center, they go to a small retailer or another non-participating large retailer. You're going to be looking out for that, hoping that doesn't happen. What if, instead of doing either of those two things, they start throwing away the container that they previously took to their local grocery store? So grandma with her six-pack of RC a week is accustomed to taking it to the local grocery store. When it stops taking containers, she doesn't want to drive a mile and a half. She goes to, you know, puts it in the trash because that's the easier choice. So are you going to be looking out for that possibility too, that redemption rates would actually decline because of, you know, for whatever reason associated with this switch?
Yeah, that's a great point. I guess the easy answer there is we certainly will be able to look at what was going back to the three large grocery retailers and compare it to what would be going to our redemption centers. But what we're envisioning will be the problem with that metric is we think that we will have people that like this system. You know, in Oregon City, for example, it's right off of 213.
Yeah.
And we've got people from Malala and Estacada and wherever that drive through this area on their way into a job and so forth, and Wood Village is the same thing. It's an arterial, or at least close to one, for I-84. So we're a little worried that if we tried to compare the volume that we see at the three or the participating retailers to what we get back, we may find that we're getting a lot back because we drew people from areas that we are so far away from the redemption center. You really wouldn't want to try to correlate the change in return patterns there. On a bigger scale, ultimately, if we were successful with all of this and we had 10 of these in a quadrant of Portland open or wherever in a town, say Salem, then we, I think, could look at total redemption rates for the entire area without having kind of cross-area influences and determine whether we increased it or we decreased it. But it's a great question, ultimately. I mean, that's the number one question in the whole thing. Are we going to make this better overall or worse?
Okay. Representative Smith.
Thanks for sure. Yeah, I had a similar question, but we might want to consider the overall percentage of returns as related to the overall sales, and then taking your that you might get out of region returns, and then this will lead to a point I want to make on the record. We sort of tag and track cans like we do wildlife, and see if the percentage of tagged and tracked cans is the same as it is what we would predict it to be. That would be one way of measuring. My concern with all of this, because I can sort of tease out sort of the way a interesting bureaucratic process might work, and that's my concern. That I actually applaud you and your team for, I think, trying to take on a set of innovative solutions to try to preserve the intent of the bottle. I think it's very laudable. The concern I want to suggest to the committee and to the throngs of Oregonians, I'm sure, watching us by satellite feed. Exactly. Like my dad and my dad, I think it's it. is that as we started, it was worth, and the buying power of a nickel was equivalent to the buying power of a quarter now. So it was worth it for not just fraternity men or homeless people to return a satchel of cans, but it was worth it for a house husband and, family or me when I was a kid and I wanted a Snickers bar to gather a few and go back. And now it's just the numbers just don't work. So I think we should, and I know that the shock to the system is saying, hey, let's raise it to a dime horrors would, I know that would yield resistance, but we might consider some sort of indexing after we're never going to get elected again, 10 years from now, considering raising it at some point, because I think our choice is essentially going to be either build a big bureaucracy, right? Something, try this, and maybe it gets bigger and more robust, which maybe is better, maybe not, or maybe we try to recapture the intent of the bottle bill by making it more middle-class friendly by keeping up with inflation.
Well, great point, and you certainly touched on a hot button topic. And you get elected, and I get fired, so I'm going to be careful what I say about 10 cents. But as an industry, I would say generally, we're at a point where we're open to all reasonable discussion on what makes the bottle bill work and what needs to be done to improve it. And I think we've talked in the past, the bottle bill tap came up with a concept where a tool for manipulating redemption rates certainly is the value of what you get when you return it. So perhaps an idea is to tie a redemption rate goal to the value of it, and if the goal isn't achieved, you use that tool, the value of it, to try to manipulate that up. And I think we're open to that. It's kind of been a hands-off topic, I think, for the industry in the past, but there's a point, if you take it extremes, 1,000 years from now, if we're still having this discussion about a nickel, it will be quite comical. So there's a point where it, maybe the toolbox has to be opened up in that respect.
John, there, we only have a few minutes left, and Tom, and there are a couple of points that I want to cover. One, I want to find out whether you have data on water bottles and redemption rate in the year plus of experience that we have now since those have entered the system. So that's one. And perhaps before we get there, though, quickly you could describe how redemption centers, in your view, play into a possible expansion of containers within the... What's the connection, if there is any, between establishing and building out redemption centers and eventually expanding the containers to include the teas, the sports drinks, et cetera, that are not currently covered?
Okay. Great. Well, I got 6 minutes, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, from an expansion standpoint, I think that most retailers would agree that if they thought it was burdensome before 707 in terms of the space needed in their stores to collect empties back, we're really to the point now where we can't fit a lot more into the existing spaces in grocery retailers. Now, I think there's a distinction between smalls and larges, and that's a whole nother topic. But looking at those participating retailers in the Redemption Center program and the amount of space dedicated to their back room, and frankly, a lot of these stores have been built now with hallways in the back room with different types of ways of receiving inventory and so forth, it wouldn't matter whether they wanted to or not. They're out of room without or significant remodel. So I think the issue of expansion comes back to the system's ability to handle it. And we survived, I think, the water and flavored water in terms of being able to collect and redistribute the deposits for that and the capacity issue. But as we think about expansion in the future, I think redemption centers are critical to that. I also think an industry, both on the grocery side and the beverage distributor side, that's working together to accommodate the expansion is critical to this. So I think there's support within the industry for expansion that's reasonable. And, of course, reasonableness is subjective, but to the sports drinks, iced teas, juices, things that look like what we have today but just have a different flavor, I think there's support for that, but we've got to get forward. We've got to move forward with getting the redemption centers out, changing the way these returns are being done to accommodate larger-scale returns. So I guess that would be my answer to your second question. And then the first question regarding what's happened with water bottles and so forth, I'm hoping I have a few minutes today to talk a little bit about redemption rates, because as I understand it, I've been in this for about 18 years now, but certainly in that time and the time prior to when I was in the bottle bill business, we have never had a statewide redemption rate reported. It's been a challenge that has never been solved in trying to put together tens of different distributor groups and add up all of their numbers to arrive at a statewide redemption rate. So I want to report that today for the first time, because the co-op has been in existence for just over a year now, but we're through the 2009 year, and the co-op itself has been audited, and so now we have redemption rates. So I'm going to ask for a drum roll in a minute, but before I get there...
this is killing us.
Yeah, I know. Hang on. So you can see my notes.
Yeah, I can.
The co-op has about 70 participants. Those 70 participants represent about 95% of the state's volume. So bear in mind that the numbers I give you are lacking 5% of what is being sold in return throughout the state. But I think the number is certainly statistically an accurate number within a point or two. So the 2009 rates for cans, aluminum cans, was 83.9%. For glass bottles, it was 79.9%. For PET bottles, which includes water and flavored water in most forms, was 50.4%. And the blended total across all three categories was 75.0%. So that's those are the rates that really we saw in the first year that we were able to compile this statewide data. I think we're obviously disappointed in the PET rate, but we know what it is coming from. But one of the things that I wanted to at least touch on quickly today is the co-op's efforts to really promote the bottle bill and maybe return it to some of its lustrous form. So we've developed a mascot, Bottle Bill, and oh my goodness, here he comes now. He's struggling.
He's having redemption problems.
Bottle Bill down. If I need to, I'll go back. I knew there was a certain risk.
Symbolic, like Mr. Chair.
It won't be this hard to return the bottle.
Come on in, Bottle Bill. Nice work, ladies. Ta-da! So it's somewhat in jest, but one of the things that we tried to do, we certainly are looking now at what the redemption rates are, and we know there's been a drop in the enthusiasm and excitement about the bottle bill over the years and really what it does to litter control and resource recovery. So we've begun a campaign with Bottle Bill. And Bottle Bill's message is Be Green, Redeem. And we've taken him to the Rose Garden for the NBA's Green Week and PG Park, and we anticipate having him in schools and other community events around the state, and just starting to take the message out that there is somebody that's doing the right thing with the bottle bill and encouraging redemption. So Marge told me I have to be careful how much these are worth. They're pennies, guys. You don't have to worry about
I don't report it, so don't give me.
So anyway, in addition to that, you'll see on truck backs around the state, both our co-op members and our own OBRC trucks, a campaign where we're encouraging folks to follow through with the bottle bill and be green and redeem their container. So we know that the rates, at least for the water, aren't where they need to be, in a large part because a lot of consumers weren't aware that those things could be returned this year, but we're hoping with bottle bill that this will work. So let me know if we need to torpedo her back out or him back out the door.
Well, I'm pretty excited about the bottle bill as a result of this effort. So really appreciate it. Want to see if there are any additional questions. I think we're about at our time. Tom, thank you for continuing to monitor and work on these redemption center applications. How much staff time now at OLCC is involved? We were at a quarter FTE, I think, 2 years ago doing bottle bill work. I'm sure that's gone up a bit.
Just as a result of all this, I asked people to put together the hours they spent on this, but it's more than a quarter FTE, I can assure you. But it's okay because the majority of the stuff has been accomplished already. So we got through it. You know, we had to put other things aside that we normally would work on. We did. So.
And it is the brilliance of the bottle bill, and something we certainly seek to maintain, that it does not require a state agency or a big, you know, a lot of people in a state agency. I think less than one FTE. I also want to acknowledge Peter Spendelo and Palmer Mason, who are here from DEQ and who are also involved in the discussions about recycling and the bottle bill's role in that. So.
And Chair Cannon, just if I could beg your indulgence 1 minute, maybe I'll just submit some of the questions that have continued to come up as a result of the bottle bill and the expansion of the bottle bill, not necessarily only dealing with water, plastic bottles, but other things we continue to get. I'll just submit that and write into the committee, so
great.
Since we don't have time today.
Great, sure. Appreciate it. So, yeah, Senator Buckley.
Sure, it's Paul. If they would be kind enough to give us the raw numbers for the cans, bottles, and plastic, so we can pencil out the dollars and cents, too.
Well, I would be kind, but I don't have those. I'm sorry. But
in his written testimony.
Oh, well, he doesn't have them either.
I thought you guys were cooperating.
Well, on the Redemption Center side, I can definitely get those. And if Marge is my helper here, we'll make sure to get in contact with you and get you that information.
Great. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you, guys.
Thanks, Bottle Bill. Let's take a moment as we transition. Thank you, Marge. We will move on with a quick update on the Umatilla project. And Representative Jensen, we're going to get a little update here on Umatilla. I don't know if you want to preface this with any remarks of your own. We'll let folks transition here. But let them go ahead.
Hello, Phil.
Mr. Chair,
members. Yeah.
Thank you. I was actually hoping Representative Jensen would be the transition between the between Bob Bell and us, but since he chose not to, we'll forge ahead. For the record, Phil Ward, with Director of the Oregon Water Resources Department, with me today is Barry Norris, the Senior Water Resource Engineer for the State of Oregon, who has been our project lead for the Umatilla Aquifer Recovery Project. We didn't bring paper with us. We're trying to be a little more paperless in response to your admonitions, but we will have a PowerPoint here for you. So you may remember the Umatilla Aquifer Recovery Project was initiated, actually, the biennium prior to this one, with a $750,000 feasibility grant from the Oregon Legislature, whereby our department was charged to work with the local community to study whether it was feasible to conduct large-scale aquifer recovery in the Umatilla Basin. That initial feasibility study was positive in its result, and as a result, you all chose this last biennium to invest $2.5 million of additional state money, grant money, into this program, and then potentially $10 million this biennium and $15 million in the biennium to come of lottery-backed bond loans. And so with that, Mr. Chair, we'll charge right in. So here is the situation statewide in terms of groundwater from a quantity standpoint, from an aquifer health quantity standpoint. And you can see these are the spots in Oregon where we have administratively placed restrictions on groundwater aquifers, and Representative Jensen's neighborhood gets the prize for most restrictions relative to groundwater, and indeed we've seen groundwater declines in his in the Umatilla Basin of up to 500 feet in some irrigation wells. So this is a close-up of the Umatilla Basin, and you can see chronologically when the different aquifers in that basin were classified with the restrictions. The orange areas are actually what we call critical groundwater areas. Those are areas where not only do we prohibit new uses of the groundwater, but we have ratcheted down significantly the amount of groundwater that would have otherwise been available to farmers under their water right permits. For example, in some of these areas, we have ratcheted down what they're able to receive to around 15% of what their permit would otherwise have authorized. Okay, Barry, give your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, I'm Barry Norris, engineer with the Oregon Water Resources Department. The critical areas, the brown areas that are located up there on this map, are the is the target area for the Umatilla Basin Recharge Project. This is a diagram, a close-up of the area, and the project primarily consists of taking winter water when it's available, running it out to two alluvial areas. The one on the left is what's called the Columbia Line Recharge Area, and the number one and number two is the Echo Meadows area. Both of those are basin sediments. They're sands and gravels, and the idea is to run winter water out on those sands and gravels, let it infiltrate into the ground, pardon me, and then use it during the irrigation season and other parts of the year as needed. This is a schematic of the way the project would operate. It would take winter water either out of the Umatilla or the Columbia River. It would run it out to the orange area, an alluvial aquifer, basin sediment area, where it would infiltrate into the ground, and there it would stay as storage for the irrigation season. Some of it would return to the Umatilla River to augment in-stream flow. It could be taken out during the irrigation season and directly used for irrigation, running off to the left there, IR season, or it could be taken out and moved to the right, non-IR season it's labeled, and pumped down into the deep basalt aquifers for storage for later use. Eventually, as it's shown in the deep basalt aquifer, it could run back out, pump back out for irrigation use. One of the advantages, or a couple of the advantages of the basin sediments are that, one, it would provide return flow to the Umatilla River, and the other, another one is, of course, storage, and a third one is that it cleans the water to drinking water quality as it runs through the sediments, and because of that, it can be pumped into the basalts. Water that's pumped into the basalts directly for storage, later use, has to meet water quality standards. This is a diagram of how the system, preliminary design of the system during a feasibility study. The you can see up in the upper left-hand corner, if folks would not look directly at me, I can use a pointer. I don't want to get this enshrined in anybody's eye, please. On the Columbia River, there's an existing Columbia Improvement District pipeline that runs down like this, and then the Boardman Tree Farm pipeline takes off of that main line and it runs southeasterly like this, and that's in the kind of light green or aqua color. This is a canal system that's owned by the Columbia Improvement District that's also existing, and so the system will make use of the existing infrastructure and modify that for wintertime use and expand it for a larger quantity of water to move. So this would be a new line that would run from the canal up into the recharge area, Columbia Improvement District's canal, and this would be a line that would run from the Boardman Tree Farm, the existing line, over to serve the same area. So it would run water from the Columbia River during the wintertime out into this alluvial area, the county line improvement district. This is shows a collection of that water, pumping it back out of the system and then moving it down into the irrigated areas and down either down into wells or for storage or for irrigation season use. Then some of it would return back over to the Umatilla River through those basin sediments and provide in-stream flow. The project management consists of the Oregon Water Resources Department, who under the authorization of the legislature has a grant and loan program that's getting this program started. And then the irrigators in the basin have formed the Umatilla Water Commission, and it's composed of five groups for construction and operation of the project. Umatilla County, Morrow County, Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Basin, Westland Irrigation District, and the County Line Improvement District. So there are two irrigation districts, two counties, and the Confederated Tribes. They make up the commission that provides oversight. And they're in the final stages right now of completing the organization of this commission. The fiscal support, the legislative fiscal support for the project consists of the $750,000 that was authorized session before last, which did an investigation of the project for feasibility. That project was completed by last July and showed the feasibility. An economic analysis was included, as well as a technical analysis. Then last session, of course, was House Bill 3369, which authorized the grant and loan programs. And then Senate Bill 5535, which provides in lottery fund-backed bonds, funds of $2.5 million for initial implementation. Realizing that this project, just the schematic I showed you just a minute ago, was originally estimated at maybe $100 million. So this provides some implementation money to get things rolling. And then this biennium, there is authorization in general obligation bonds for a $10,000 loan, or $10 million loan. And then again in the next biennium for a $15 million loan. So there's money there to get things rolling and pursue this project. The project at this point is laid out in this manner. There are seven tasks, and this is a work plan that, again, is in the final stages of completion by the commission, but it's essentially laid out this way. Project management, $250,000 for project management, which was going to include a detailed work plan, legal services, managing the project with a consultant to do some construction management, as well as some support for the commission. $40,000 for scoping the beneficial use, which is a public outreach program to work with stakeholders and to find out who's going to be in with this. How much water do we need to do in this initial phase? And then that can lead to the cost per acre foot and so forth, the $40,000. So they're going to go out and meet with folks and see who's going to sign up for the project. Three is property negotiations and site surveys. As you can imagine, there's a lot of varied ownership in this area. This is going to be some work that will establish where the construction corridors are going to be, for instance, and figure out how to do the easements or purchase a property or what needs to be done to acquire authority to get on that property and start building the project, as well as use of the existing infrastructure. That's owned by different entities, and so to make use of that, there's going to have to be some negotiation to figure out how that's going to be done. Water right and water right acquisition. That's going to consist of work that's going to be done to evaluate the existing pump stations, figure out what needs to be done to those pump stations to winterize them, possibly add additional pumps, what work needs to be done on the intakes, and then what work needs to be done to actually acquire the water rights to do this under ASR and AR and eventually the secondary use permits. Number five is the design and engineering. That part is for the recovery system, which takes the water after it's pumped out of the Columbia River and moves it out to the alluvial areas. And then once it's in the alluvial areas, that part that's not going to, and then recovering that water out of the alluvial areas and moving it to the areas for irrigation or for injecting it into the basalt system. Task six is operation monitoring and maintenance plan. How's the project going to be operated? How's it going to be monitored to see how much water is left in storage for use? Where is that water moving? How much is moving toward the Umatilla River, monitoring that so that we can protect that water? A provision in 3369 requires that 25% of the water is placed in the basin sediments, has to remain in there for ecological benefits. Including return flow to the Umatilla River. So we've got to figure out what portion, if all of it, and if not all of it, is moving to the Umatilla River, and how do we protect that? And we've got to figure out how much, where, and when it, returns. Task seven is aquifer recharge and limitation. That's a major portion of the grant. You can see $990,000. That's going to be a small actual construction of some facilities that will actually move water over to the alluvial areas, Echo Meadows and the Columbia Line, and recharge it, or initially charge it to the basin sediments, recover that, and inject it down into basalts as a demonstration to folks out there and you and everybody else that this is how this project's going to work and we're actually putting water in the ground. So that's how that's laid out.
And Mr. Norris, we're almost out of time here. I'd love to get a chance for committee to ask any questions.
That's
perfect. There are the pictures.
Wow.
That's what I was looking for.
Gorgeous.
Great. So Representative Smith or Jensen, of course, a lot of the moving forward on this project is the result of your incredible work in 2009. And I wonder if you have any questions or comments or anyone else.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it's certainly refreshing, you know, to see what actually has been a decade or more worth of effort coming to some fruition, and that we are going to be looking at increased economic activity in the area. I think when we can put more water on the ground, we can irrigate some ground that we probably have not been able to put into irrigated agriculture that's been dry land or what have you. The increased production, you know, realistically should also increase growth of crops there, should also lead to some after-harvest production, you know, to ship products all around the world. which of course we do now, but there will be more product and more jobs that will go with that. And I think there are several things that really brought this project together and made it possible. And that was the formation of a coalition a couple of years ago, a little longer than that, 10 years ago, when we ran into the groundwater threatened, endangered, or hazard area there, and the groundwater was no longer as available as it might have been for our forefathers. The ability of a very diverse group of people to work together to come up with a plan, quite frankly, took a lot of time and a lot of energy, and it was my good fortune in this case to be in the right place at the right time, I guess, to simply make something or help make something happen that agricultural community and the economic development community in Eastern Oregon had been talking about and thinking about and working on for a long time. So there's a lot of satisfaction with where we've come, how far we've come, and it is my hope that as this particular project continues, that in some ways it will serve as a model for how maybe other parts of the state, and realizing it that this is a very diverse state with a lot of different sources of water and a lot of different problems with it, but that the process that was gone through will provide a model for others to be able to work with to be able to accomplish similar sorts of activities or get similar sorts of results in other areas. So, and it was certainly my privilege and pleasure to be able to work with this committee, and especially with you, Chair Cannon, and then also to get the enthusiastic and seemingly inexhaustible energy of Representative Smith as he joined in and looked at possibly making something happen. So I'd leave other comments to Representative Smith.
I won't belabor too much. The one thing I hope I would echo in spades the honor to work with Representative Jensen. The one takeaway I would hope that we as a committee and as a room full of people and as a legislative body, as a state, take away is the potential value and importance of identifying win-win-win water projects and investing in those around the state. And that if we, and I say all three wins on purpose, if we invest, water is critical. If we don't grow, we don't eat. If we try to do projects without an environmental benefit, or at least with at worst an environmental detriment, they will get blocked or be long-term detrimental. And third, if we don't do it fiscally responsible, we'll kill the golden goose. And I think we've seen the political football being passed around the WRD budget. I think we've seen it around investment or the failure to do so in water projects. And I hope that we'll find a collaborative path forward, going forward with whomever the legislators happen to be on these things. What are the other, luckily there's not too many big red zones, but there's yellow zones. And, with the scope of development of what's happening with water availability in the West, who knows what it's going to be like 20 years from now. I hope we will look for that. And then I guess I will say one other thing, and that is in that analysis, I hope we'll also consider future water needs for the state. That's the thing that is hardest to bring to bear around a work group table, and thanks to the people who did far more work than certainly I in figuring this out. I mean, it took expertise that certainly I didn't possess, but it's hardest to bring around a voice of expertise around the future water needs because, some of those people haven't been hired yet. And I hope we'll keep those things in mind as well.
Thank you.
Great comments, and certainly the two of you have created a template for doing this kind of work in with addressing water needs in other parts of the state. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to compliment and commend the City Mouse and the Country Mouse for working together in a bipartisan manner, and also the expertise of our department head and all his little mice out there. But this, you know, in a day that we got such bad news, this is good news. I mean, if you look at the numbers up there, these are real jobs, and this is an upbeat thing for us to be looking at today. And it's been a long time coming, and I really appreciate all your hard work that you did, and you too, Mr. Chair, for making this happen. Thank you.
Great. Thanks. We will move on, switch gears once again, to the discussion of pesticide issues. The topics here, this will be a broad-ranging conversation. The three topics that are listed on the agenda are not necessarily meant to be directly connected, but they are all related to pesticides. And we'll start by hearing from Lisa Arkin and anyone else, Lisa, who you want to, Josh, bring up to talk about integrated pest management. And we'll make sure you have your full 15 minutes, even if it means cutting into our break a little. Hopefully you'll reserve at least some portion of that for question and answer.
Thank you, Chair Cannon and members of the Joint Committee. My name is Lisa Arkin. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Toxics Alliance, and with me today is Josh Vincent. He is a staff member for Oregon Toxics Alliance, and we'll be sharing this educational presentation today. And we appreciate very much the opportunity to be here and address this topic before you. All right, so let's go to our next slide. We got a slide. This picture you see was taken this past spring at Washington Park in Lane County. And the child here came to the park to do his homework, and little did he know that he would choose to sit in an area that had just been recently sprayed with synthetic chemicals. But this happens more often than you might think. For example, not long ago on a sunny spring day, I was walking through the Capitol Mall on my way to this building, which is a beautiful place to walk during the spring. And ahead of me, there was a mother with a toddler in tow by the hand and a baby in a stroller. They were going through the park, and she was talking to her animated toddler and checking in at the baby in the stroller there, and unknowingly walked through a mist. And she was unaware. She kept going, but I, being behind her, stopped and asked the state employee what was being sprayed. And he replied that he was spraying glyphosate. Glyphosate is an herbicide that it has, in science research, is possibly linked to a hormone disruption, and also has been detected in bone tissue after exposure. So this mother had unknowingly and wittingly exposed her very small children to exposure to poison simply by taking them for a walk in the park on that day. And the question being, should that mother expect that when she's going through state property that her family could be safe? Elected officials around the country are acting to make sure that public places are safe for kids and families. For example, on Tuesday, New York Governor David Patterson signed the Safe Child Playing Fields Act into law, and he banned the cosmetic use of pesticides on playgrounds and on playfields, sporting fields. And the New York law comes on the heels of a new study that you probably saw in the news, plastered all over the news last week, linking some pesticides with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD. And also in the news recently was former President Bush's cancer panel report, which concluded, and I quote, "The true burden of environmentally induced cancers has been grossly underestimated," close quote. And this report pointed out that pesticides are a chemical of top concern for human health. So it's entirely fitting that state government discuss how to protect the public health. In the early 1990s, the Oregon legislature passed a statute requiring the use of integrated pest management for the operation and maintenance of all state agencies, or most state agencies. So I appreciate the opportunity today to review this IPM requirement, where it stands now, and how it relates to legislation that was recently passed in 2009. So this small diagram here is probably familiar to you. It's a snapshot of a definition of integrated pest management, or IPM. This is a decision-making process that coordinates the use of all the techniques shown here to prevent unacceptable levels of pest damage by cost-effective means while posing the least possible risk to people, to property, and to the environment. So IPM prioritizes reducing chemical pesticide use in favor of effective and safer alternatives. And it's been found to manage pests in all sorts of arenas, whether you're in a developed public facility or natural habitat. And it's been shown to be cost-effective and to improve infrastructure going on. So in 2009, the legislature here passed two laws that answered the need to reduce exposures to pesticides. One was Senate Bill 637. That was an effort spearheaded by Senator Buonamici. And that bill created the School Integrated Pest Management Policy. This is cornerstone legislation, and I served on the broad stakeholder group that worked on that bill. The second bill is House Bill 2212, stewarded by Representative Clem, and that mandated the protection of human health, the environment, and water resources in the event that an herbicide is used to control noxious and invasive weeds. So on this slide, you see the hallmarks of Senate Bill 637, which have to do with protecting safety of people, making sure buildings and grounds have integrity and are well-maintained, protecting local ecosystem health, not allowing the routine application of pesticides for aesthetic purposes, mandating the use of low-impact pesticides should one be needed if other methods have proven ineffective, and making sure that there's adequate posting so for the public to be aware. According to a report published by the Integrated Pest Management Institute of North America, pesticide use in schools and other buildings has been reduced 71 to 93% with no long-term cost increases. I'm going to turn this presentation over to Josh, who's going to discuss now how the state IPM policy can support Oregon's efforts to reduce persistent bioaccumulative pollutants. Thank you.
Great. We have about six more minutes, John.
Okay, so. I'll go fast. Again, Josh Vincent. I am a staff member with Oregon Toxics Alliance. Now, as Lisa mentioned, IPM is not new to Oregon. We did this back in the 1990s. The issue at hand is that this policy is now nearly 20 years, and so it is out of date. It doesn't reflect the latest science. What we'd like to see is new IPM statutes reflecting the latest science, especially as it relates to human and environmental health. There's a lot of evidence now, especially from the medical community, that suggests a connection between chemical pesticides and human diseases such as cancer, autism, and neurodegenerative disease. And this is particularly important in cases of children. We also want to note that there is evidence supporting a linkage between pesticide proliferate use and the collapse of bee colonies, not just in Oregon, but nationwide, and that this can have disastrous effects on agricultural industries, which obviously would impact our economy here as well. So what we would like to see is a new IPM statute based on, again, the latest science, and that takes this into account, establishing a hierarchy of management options that would prioritize the least toxic alternatives. Now, going to ORS 634.655, which was the original statute defining IPM in the state, it required IPM it required state agencies with pest control responsibilities to adhere to the protocols of IPM. So what agencies would those be? Agriculture, fish and wildlife, transportation, you have your major state agencies on there. In addition, this was a requirement for institutions of higher education as well. So University of Oregon, OSU, PSU, they would fall under this provision.
The next section in 634 provided for jobs and training for agency employees. And this was so that IPM education would be provided to agency staffers, particularly those who do the actual pest control. And then, of course, to help programs evolve. There would be IPM coordinators within each agency to oversee the record keeping and the monitoring. So pursuant to this, what happened in 2001 was the passage of ORS 413, which abolished the Interagency Integrated Pest Management Committee. Basically what happened was assets were transferred to the Invasive Species Council. So 634 was left on the books, but it was stripped of its assets and stripped of its authority to operate any of these IPM programs. Now, here in Oregon, after this occurred, many of the state agencies still pursued benefits of IPM on their own. And of course, they were managed to have some success, but what we're looking for is direction from the legislature and perhaps funding so that they will have resources to provide more adequate training and more education for their staff members. We also have an opportunity to build on a lot of the great things that have been done. Listed here, the Pesticide Stewardship Partnership between DEQ, ODA, and Oregon State University, Integrated Plant Protection Center, which is located at OSU, Senate Bill 737, which was the priority persistent pollutant list for surface waters, Oregon DEQ Water Quality Standards Review, and then, of course, burgeoning pilot projects in Lane and Lincoln counties, which use herbicides only as a last resort. This is implementing integrated vegetation management along roadsides. Simply in terms of advantages for IPM, the obvious one is that it is far less toxic than conventional pest control methods. According to the USDA, expanding IPM programs would reduce human health risks posed by threats and the tactics used to manage them, while also reducing or mitigating adverse environmental effects of pest management practices. And this is very important because conventional pest management practices, like spraying pesticides, have many adverse impacts and plenty of those which are very hard to quantify. As an example, a 2008 report by the U.S. Geological Survey detected 63 different pesticides in Oregon's waters. And oftentimes these were detected at levels that do not support aquatic species like coho salmon. And this is a large problem for us here in the Northwest, particularly in Oregon. On top of that, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, in conjunction with the USGS, later found that certain combinations of pesticides were killing salmon in nature, even after they had conducted lab trials, which suggested that these were going to be safe. So the full impacts of what's happening out there in the ecosystem are not even widely known. So reducing these toxics can have large impacts, not only on fish, but on communities of people as well. One of those is cost. Now, in terms of environmental remediation, the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board alone, between 2007 and 2008, spent over $63 million on watershed enhancement projects here in the state. Now, it's not clear or easy to come up with some kind of a financial figure to tell how much of that is consequent of pesticide contamination. But what we can say is that implementing IPM and reducing the use of toxics will clearly reduce the state's own impact on Oregon waterways. And then by reducing impact, your chances are likely of reducing many of these remediative costs as well. Now, as an example of what you might expect in terms of scale and increased costs, we can look at Washington's initial switch to state agency IPM programs back in the year 2000. This chart shows the years 1998 and 1999 average monthly costs for state agency pest control spending. The year 2000 was when they began their statewide IPM program, so you can see a spike in cost there. Subsequent to that, in the year 2001, their monthly spending had dropped back down to within $91 of what they were originally spending on monthly pest control costs. And so much of the expenditure associated with implementing IPM happens to fall under startup costs. And so you're paying for things like improving waste management systems, moving your garbage and recycling away from structures so that there isn't the possibility for pests to infest. things like installing physical barriers, like air curtains and things of that nature, in kitchens and areas where food is prepared so that you reduce intrusion from flying insects and things like that. Structural maintenance on buildings, fixing cracks, fixing leaky pipes, which are just general things which improve the conditions and make it harder for pests to develop. And then training and certifying staff. These are the things that constitutes startup costs for IPM. They don't necessarily represent repeating costs that you have to deal with as a matter of implementation.
Josh, if you'll wrap it up.
Sure thing. So, getting back to the main point of this, I mean, pesticides are designed to interfere with the well-being of living things. So there's an inherent risk in using those, even with everything that we know. If there are ways to reduce use of toxics, feasible ways to do that, then we should be working to do that. So we would like to see Oregon IPM statutes brought up to date so that they harmonize with current laws, as Lisa mentioned, which redefine IPM based on new science and new medical evidence that we have. So
great.
We'll open it up for questions at this point.
I appreciate it. Are there any quick questions for these folks? Well, I appreciate you being here. It's a subject that I'm interested in following up on, and I've talked to Representative Clem about getting some agency folks together with you and any other stakeholders who are interested in this topic to discuss to what extent these principles of integrated pest management are followed already within state agencies, to what extent they're not, and to what extent they could be, and what role a law might play in doing that. I have warned Lisa and Josh of the state of our finances. They're only worse today than they were yesterday, and so they, I think, understand that it is unlikely to be possible to do something that adds significantly, even adds at all, to the cost of agency operations. But as you've shown through your the citations here, there may be ways that this can actually save the state money, and I hope that we'll take that kind of look at the possibilities. So appreciate the work that you've done. I'll be pulling together a group to discuss this, and if anyone in the audience or listening is interested in participating, I'd be more than welcome. Be more than welcome to attend. Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this may have already been mentioned, but I simply want to note that when you look at the overall budget costs, of course, we include health care in our budget.
Yeah.
This may result in a substantial savings, even if the immediate budget is actually a little higher.
Great point.
Yeah, that's often the case. I mean, we have plenty of information that we would love to follow up with you with. We're starting to develop ways where you can quantify full costs of using these conventional pest control methods. It's not just purchasing of the chemicals and paying for labor and things like that. You have these environmental remediation expenses, and you have health care, settlements, PR. There's all kinds of things that you can take into account when it comes to that. So we'd be happy to talk to you more about that as well.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for being here. And we're going to go ahead and hear from Kevin Masterson at DQ. Kevin, if you're ready to come up, we'll take these just slightly out of order. So I'm advised that there may be a little more coherence in the three pesticide-related presentations if we hear from DEQ next. And Palmer as well. You can go ahead and get started.
Sounds good.
As soon as you're ready.
Great. Chair Cannon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Masterson, and I'm the agency toxics coordinator with the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. And I'm here today to briefly talk to you about a toxics reduction strategy that we're working on at DEQ and its connections to pesticides. So over a year ago, DEQ made the decision to develop a comprehensive and integrated toxics reduction strategy, partly because of the sheer magnitude of the potential problem with over 80,000 chemicals in commerce, and that number continuing to grow, and the fact that we don't know a lot about those chemicals, and also because these chemicals often don't respect our artificial regulatory boundaries that we set up through the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, Superfund, etc. Combustion byproducts like PAHs often get discharged to the air, they deposit to the land, and they run off to the water. And that is the case for many different types of chemicals, mercury being another notable. So we decided that we need to take a different approach to managing toxics than the more traditional approach. This strategy that we're now working on also is designed to get us to take a more comprehensive approach and go beyond a chemical-by-chemical approach, which if we tried to work on one chemical at a time, we would probably be working on it for a long this problem for a long time. So we also wanted to be able to do a better job with managing our resources, being more efficient with our scarce resources by working across programs and with other agencies. And finally, we wanted to be more proactive rather than reactive and having a strategy in place that sets our direction rather than just reacting to various proposals from the outside. We thought would be an advantage. We identified seven discrete steps in developing this toxics reduction strategy, and we've completed the first task at the end of last year, which was to identify high-priority toxic chemicals for DEQ, and I'll talk about that in just a moment. Right now, we're in the midst of working on three other major tasks that will pretty much comprise the meat of the strategy, and those three tasks are collecting data on those toxic chemicals and identifying sources and pathways to the environment through the collection of that data, assessing current needs or gaps in existing programs that are designed to reduce toxics in the environment, and then identify new or modified toxics reduction opportunities based on that analysis. So we're trying to use a very logical and science-based approach to identifying new opportunities. And then finally, in the next 6 months or so, we'll be trying to develop a final draft of our strategy and an implementation plan that goes along with it that will outline timelines and lead agencies and individuals that will be leading the effort on the strategy. And by early next year, we hope to have a final strategy that we can present to the EQC after going out for public comment and getting input on the draft strategy. And I should also note that we have been meeting with a stakeholder group since the beginning of this process, an external stakeholder group that's comprised of a very wide array of different groups, from nonprofit, environmental, and public health groups to forestry, ag, interests, other agencies, industry. And we'll continue to meet with that group through the course of the development of the strategy. So I mentioned this high-priority list of chemicals that we developed. We're calling it our focus list, and that list is based on existing priorities that we have in other programs or interagency efforts. And we did a look at everything that's going on with our programs and projects. We found 11 different priority lists of chemicals already there. So rather than reinventing the wheel and coming up with a brand new process, we looked at those 11 different lists, and by prioritizing those that had an interest or a connection to other programs, we came up with 52 different chemicals or grouped classes of chemicals. A couple of those are current use pesticide, combustion byproducts, consumer product constituents, and you can see the other four different categories there. Current use pesticides comprise about 30% of that list of that 52. And one notable gap with current use pesticides as well as consumer product constituents is that we don't have very many environmental standards. Very few, a very small percentage of these compounds have environmental standards like water quality standards, air quality standards. And so that's an obvious gap. And we are looking to identifying more of those program needs or gaps. In the case of current use pesticides, we're fortunate in that we already have a structure in place to evaluate various opportunities for further protection of the environment through this interagency water quality pesticide management team. It was formed about a year and a half, 2 years ago, and is operating under a memorandum of agreement. So we've got DEQ, Oregon Department of Ag, Human Services, and Forestry working together. We meet once a month to coordinate the implementation of various programs. We've identified a process for looking at needs that exist with regard to the protection of surface water and groundwater, and we're identifying potential actions that we can take. And now that we have this toxics reduction strategy process underway, any ideas that come out of that process will be able to go through this structure and be evaluated and assessed. In terms of what we are doing in order to advance some of the objectives that we have is to build on existing efforts and try to identify opportunities to reduce chemical contamination or toxics contamination at the source. And of course, whenever possible, we want to be able to identify strategies that reduce multiple pollutants rather than just a single chemical. But in terms of building on existing efforts, we are looking at, through this pesticide management team, ways that we can enhance existing efforts like the Pesticide Stewardship Partnership, which DEQ has been involved with for about 9 or 10 years now, and it's a program that involves doing monitoring of streams and identifying where there are elevated levels of pesticides, and then working with technical assistance resources like the Oregon State University's soil water conservation districts and grower groups in order to focus best management practices in the areas where we need them the most. And we've had a fair bit of success in lowering the levels of pesticides in streams and the frequency of detection of those pesticides. But this illustration gives you an idea of what the components of that program are, and it also gives you an idea of how we want to structure the identification of opportunities through our toxics reduction strategy, specifically by starting with the specific chemical or pollutant class, in this case current use pesticides, identifying what the sources and pathways to the environment are, and then developing strategies based on where those sources and pathways are. In the case of the Pesticide Stewardship Partnership and current use pesticides, we're looking at drift from application that gets into the water. We're looking at runoff in an urban setting through impervious surfaces, and in the rural settings through erosion and soil runoff, and then also spills and leaks of product containers. So we've been able to work with our partners by communicating this data about potential drift and runoff and the monitoring results that show where the problems are, and help to enhance and focus these existing efforts already. And one example is that we are working very closely with Oregon State University Extension and their Integrated Plant Protection Center on an intensive IPM program in a couple of Willamette watersheds. They picked those watersheds based on the data that we identified because they didn't want to spread their resources throughout the state and put on one workshop in all 36 counties. They wanted to do some intensive effort where there was an environmental need. And we've already had about four different workshops in those two watersheds, and they're developing online tools and other technical assistance resources for growers in those areas. And clearly, although IPM is designed to meet the needs of growers by controlling pests, weeds, and diseases in the most efficient manner, a collateral benefit of IPM, obviously, is is water quality protection, environmental protection by the use of a number of different control methods, including ones that don't rely on pesticides. So we see that this is an opportunity for our agencies to work together. We're very much looking forward to expanding these partnerships that we have in place and being able to come back here and show the success environmentally of those efforts.
Thanks, Kevin. Let's see if there are any quick questions. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The success, the measure of success is of interest to me. So some of these things don't have standards. It sounds like you might have to develop them in order to know what success is. The reason I ask is because all of our departments, everything we're going to be looking at carefully to see if we can continue to fund them given the news today. So one's ability to come back in any department and say, here's the cost and here's the benefits, is going to become increasingly important. So can you share with us what it is, how you can come back and say, yes, we've expanded the program, yes, we're in partnerships with these other groups, but more importantly, we're succeeding at, and then tell me what level, what's success?
Chair Cannon, Representative Benz, that's a very good question. We are looking at developing benchmarks for aquatic life for many of these pesticides that do not have standards now. In fact, the EPA Office of Pesticides has developed interim benchmarks that we're using to give us an idea of what the relative level of impact is of some of these pesticides. And in addition, what we tell grower groups and others when we go into a watershed is that we're looking for that line to come down. No matter what the level is, there's a benefit in seeing decreased concentrations of pesticides and decreased frequency. And obviously, if the pesticide is getting into the water, it means it's not getting on the target crop, assuming it's a non-aquatic pesticide, and that it's in everybody's interest to see more of that getting on the target crop and less into the water. So overall, we can all agree that it's good to see that those levels coming down. But you're right, we need to be able to share with people what a level of concern is. And so right now we're using those EPA benchmarks as an interim tool. They developed them, and they're also working with the Office of Water to try to harmonize those with existing water quality standards methodologies. So we do have something to go on. And we obviously aren't looking at developing water quality standards for all these because it would take a month of Sunday. But we do know that there are existing benchmarks out there that we can use, at least in a collaborative way, to say to be able to communicate to the folks that are using these pesticides that here's a level of concern, here's where we're at, and to be able to show, in terms of our monitoring results, where we are relative to those benchmarks. But we also want to be able to show wherever we start that baseline that it's coming down. The levels are coming down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's my point. There's got to be more than just the level coming down, because there's got to be a standard against which you're measuring it. Otherwise, there becomes a point where we're investing for no good purpose. So right. What I'm most interested in is seeing what that standard is and making sure that we're not engaging in this exercise for nothing more than just to see something go down when it may make no sense. Right. So I'm anxious to see those standards and the source of them.
Yeah, we can share those with you. I should also mention there's some other concerns that aren't captured by some of these benchmarks, like multiple detections at low concentrations. In some cases, we found some of these pesticides in 90 to 100% of the samples we take, but they're well below those benchmarks. Is that a concern? We don't know. What if you find 16 of these pesticides in one sample? Is that a concern? Even though they're below the benchmark. You know, obviously, we know fish don't swim through one pesticide and then wash off and go through another. So there are these issues about mixtures and additive effects. We just don't know what those are. And we're trying to craft as an interagency team right now what our response is. Do we just ignore that, or do we try to do more research in that area?
Kevin, thanks very much for your work and for the presentation. We'll look forward to following this effort as it moves forward, perhaps get an update from you in September or December, but appreciate being briefed today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's shift to presentation from Annette Leib, and Janet Foltz and Lisa Hansen.
Chair Cannon, members of the joint committees. My name is Annette Leiba. I am the manager of the surface water management section for the Department of Environmental Quality. With me, I have Lisa Hansen, the deputy director of the Department of Agriculture, and Janet Foltz, manager of their pesticide program. And as you can see, I'm going to go low-tech today, so I don't know if somebody wants to turn this off or the lights up. I'll leave that up to you. There are two things being passed out to you right now. One is the presentation that I'm going to go over, and oh, wake up! and the other is a recently released fact sheet by the Environmental Protection Agency on the work that they're doing for the permit for pesticide applications. Just to give you a quick overview of the presentation today, I'm going to cover very quickly the Clean Water Act definitions, which are relevant here, brief history of the case law that occurred prior to EPA's original rule for pesticide application in 2006, a summary of EPA's rule that was recently invalidated by the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, and then update you on the progress that EPA has made since then.
And this sounds like a lot for our brief time and our other presenters, and I guess I'm interested in knowing sort of what you hope the legislature can or should do and should know with respect to this complicated subject. So
I
don't know if
that
helps. That may expand, not contract presentation.
Let's go, if you could please turn to page 7. And we'll start with the page that talks about effect of the court case. So as I was briefly mentioning originally, EPA adopted a rule in 2006 for the application of pesticides over water and on forest canopy where pesticide residues could actually go into water. That rule was invalidated by the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals in January of 2009. So EPA is now in the position of having to develop a permit because their 2006 rule said that if these pesticides were applied consistent with the labeling requirements by the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, Rodenticide Act, that no Clean Water Act permit would be needed. That rule was invalidated, so EPA is now in the position of actually needing to develop a permit. The decision was actually, review was requested by the United States Supreme Court, which they denied. So the Environmental Protection Agency requested a stay in the court's decision until April 2011. So EPA has until 2011 to develop a permit, and the state of Oregon, who has delegated authority under the Clean Water Act, will also need to develop a permit in the state of Oregon.
Mr. Chair, you don't have page 7.
Yeah, I was wondering about that as well. We have what appears to be a 6-slide, 3-page presentation.
Okay. Mine printed out differently. So you've got 2 slides per page. That means
yes. We
should be at the top of page 4.
Okay. Would that be...
effective court case?
Yeah, I think we probably only got every other page photocopied. My guess is that we
better.
Have half of your presentation. We have the odd-numbered pages.
Well, that'll make it easier for me to get to the point. and again, my apologies. Where we're at with EPA is they established a work group with the state environmental organizations and departments of agriculture to help them in developing a permit that will come out. And EPA's permit really will only be effective in those areas where there are not states that have authorized programs. But we will be looking at the EPA permit as sort of the model that we will use here in Oregon when we develop our permit. And both the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality and the Department of Agriculture have been participating in the EPA work group. The permit that EPA intends to issue for public comment by the end of this month, we're actually thinking it's going to come out for public comment at the end of this week, will cover 4 types of pesticide applications. Mosquito and other flying insect pest control, aquatic weed and algae, aquatic nuisance and animal control, so things like zebra mussels and other invasive species, and forest canopy pest control. So it's really focused on those four activities. And what EPA has done in the early drafts that have been released to the work group but not to the public is developed a tiered approach, and one of the things that has been very controversial and confusing is how the tiers are actually going to be implemented and to whom they apply. The elements of their tiered approach that will apply to everyone are that everybody will have to minimize their discharges, so use the least amount of pesticide possible. They'll have to work to prevent leaks and spills. They'll have to calibrate and maintain their equipment to get the greatest efficiency when they do apply pesticides. They'll have to report and take corrective action if there are any adverse incidents. And they'll have to use integrated pest management. The main difference in the tiers is that for those applicators who are in the lower tier and will not actually be required to register under the permit, but are required to comply with the permit, it's a very unique approach that EPA is taking and one that we expect will get a lot of public comment. But for those people who will be required to comply with the permit but not register, they're not actually going to be required to put together a written pesticide discharge management plan. That's the main difference between the larger applicators who will be required to register under the permit and obtain the permit. They'll have to have a written pesticide management plan. So the thing that we really would like the legislature to know is that the Department of Environmental Quality is working very carefully and closely with the Department of Agriculture, and you will likely see a legislative concept and or a policy option package for shared implementation of the permit. Currently in Oregon, you have the Department of Environmental Quality responsible for implementing and issuing the Clean Water Act permits, and you have the Oregon Department of Agriculture responsible for implementing the Oregon Pesticide Act as well as the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act. So there are some overlapping areas of expertise. Obviously, the Department of Agriculture has already the contacts and the conduits for public education and outreach for those folks who are going to be required to comply with this permit. They do over 1,000 different trainings a year. So we are looking and working together on how to create a collaborative implementation effort that will maximize the expertise of both of our agencies, and that may involve some additional legislative authority.
Great. Thank you.
So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. And again, my apologies for the copying mistake.
Yeah, thanks. Let's see if your colleagues at the Department of Agriculture have anything to add.
For the record, Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Department of Ag. And Janet and I are here to answer any questions that would be related to the pesticide side of the programs that are implemented with ODA, and if there were questions about what we do in terms of licensing, certification, and registration of these pesticide products that are coming into question.
Okay, great. Any questions for these guests? Well, seeing that, I appreciate the update. I'm sorry that the time was so brief. And as we move towards a legislative session, if this committee expects to have anything to do with action on, you know, the item that you discussed, or any of the topics that have been brought up earlier by DEQ or by the Toxics Alliance, we'll be sure to invite spend more time on this, invite a broader range of stakeholders, and make sure that we're giving an opportunity for these issues to be even more fully heard. But this was a chance to get just a snapshot of what may be to come, and I appreciate you alerting us to this.
Yes, thank you very much for your time, and we're also happy to come back in September if that would be helpful.
Great. Thanks very much. Thank you. And let's recess until 3 o'clock, just a brief break before we pick up again. So committee is on recess until 3.
Mr. Chair, you were doing a great job.
Committee to get people?
Yeah. So we're going to call back to order the House Committee on Environment and Water. If folks could take their seats or take their conversations in the hallway.
I've watched the basketball. I don't think the Senate Committee even, I don't think I even gave you a chance to recess. You don't have to gamble.
A modicum of human condition.
You just stayed and continue working.
We continue to work through our break.
This is best, Chair.
I wonder why I had to let John do it.
Thanks for folks' patience. We will carry on with the agenda. So Tom Beiler and Renee Davis-Bourne, we'll bring the whole panel up if that's appropriate, Tom.
Yes, please.
So, everyone who's on the agenda, we're going to spend about a half an hour hearing about the Ecosystem Markets Work Group. Members may recall the bill that established this, Senate Bill 513, and we're interested in getting an update on how it's going. So why don't you kick us off, Tom?
Great. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, co-chairs, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Beiler. I'm the director of the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. With me today is a panel of folks who are working on the working group of the Senate Bill 513 Ecosystem Services Markets Working Group. From my left down the side is Bobby Cochran with the Willamette Partnership. We have Kathy McDonald with the Nature Conservancy, Renee Davis-Bourne at my right, who's OEB staff on point for this project, and then Chris Jarmer with the Oregon Forest Industries Council as well, all members and working closely on this effort. We're pleased to give you what I hope will be a brief update on this area, and hopefully not the last one. We want to we do have a charge to provide recommendations, policy recommendations, to the legislature. I think by January 1st of 2011, that we're on track for that. We'll give you an update on that shortly. What I want to do today is just give you a real brief teaser about ecosystem services and ecosystem services markets, and then I'm going to pass the baton to the folks here at the table who can give you a little more detail and also give you some perspective based on the areas that they represent and the interests that they represent at the table on the working group. So first of all, ecosystem services. When one looks at the bill itself, or Senate Bill 513, ecosystem services are defined as benefits that human communities enjoy as a result of natural processes and biological diversity. That can mean a lot of different things, and traditionally it's meant things like clean water, habitat for fish and wildlife, but it can also mean natural functions of the environment that have other benefits for communities. And I'll give an example of a project that's in the queue right now at OWEB for one of our investments is a grant application in Tillamook County to acquire properties adjacent to the town of Tillamook that would put pasture lands back into wetland status. That would improve habitat. It would help endangered and threatened salmon under the Federal Endangered Species Act. It would provide habitat for numerous fish and wildlife. But importantly, it would also provide an ecosystem service for the town and the county by providing flood control, by removing a bunch of levees and dikes in that area. Not only do we create habitat, but we provide an opportunity to create a natural system function that can abate and hopefully prevent and diminish the likelihood of future flooding that can affect Highway 101 and businesses in those communities. A definite win-win from our standpoint. With ecosystem services, this is an emerging field, and there are attempts around the country and Oregon is a leader in this area, as you'll hear from some of the folks at this table, to quantify the services, these ecosystem services, in a way that can help us better understand the values that we're involved with as we make decisions around land use, as we make decisions around regulatory programs, and as landowners make decisions on how they use their property. These values, I guess ultimately, the prospect would be to quantify the values of these services and be able to infuse those into decisions that could around regulatory system markets, quasi-regulatory markets, so that these could be part of the equation of and decision points for landowners and regulatory agencies, and create a different, an alternative model for addressing the natural resource and environmental needs associated with a lot of our regulatory programs today. That is a tall order. It's a complicated and a complex path that we're on. What this working group is trying to do is the initial review and kind of plowing of the earth to figure out what those issues are to wrestle with. And our goal is to provide to you some recommendations, policy recommendations, to create and develop emerging markets in Oregon as another tool in the toolkit for us to be able to work with landowners around the state and to provide a different vehicle for addressing those natural resources needs. The one way that I think about these values and how it could be transformative for landowners around the state is to think about how a landowner might have a piece of property now that has a stream running through it that has listed salmon in that. More often than not, that landowner is going to think is either going to be of the mind of, well, will probably be of the mind of, that's a liability on their property. They won't be able to develop that property because of regulations, or it would take an extreme effort to be able to get towards some ability to be able to make productive use of that land. With the idea around an ecosystem services market, that piece of property could have value in a financial value as salmon habitat, which creates and opens a door for landowners to have to look at that part of their property not as a liability but as an asset. That, I think, is transformative, and again, we're a ways away from this, but we are at a point with Oregon where we've taken strides that are being looked at nationally, and we're excited to be part of this this work group. OEB is interested in this because we invest in ecosystem services through our grant program, and we're definitely interested to see how these ideas develop and how they might complement the work that we do through our grants. With that, I'm going to pass the baton to Renee Davis Bourne, who is going to talk a little bit more detail about the working group, the process, and its function.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Renee Davis Bourne. I'm Ecosystem Services Coordinator with the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. I would like to refer you to the two handouts that you received. The first is an interim update about the 513 working group itself, and it does provide a fair amount of detail about the working group process in the event that you're interested. In the next few minutes, I'm just going to hit on some of the key highlights. First is that Senate Bill 513 was passed during the 2009 legislative session, and it does charge the Sustainability Board with convening the Ecosystem Services Markets Working Group. It has tapped OEB with staffing that working group, and specifically the working group is tasked with making policy recommendations to facilitate development of integrated ecosystem services markets in Oregon with the intent of producing both positive ecological and economic outcomes. So really just three high points that I'd like to highlight for you related to the working group itself and the process to date is, first, I'd like to mention the composition of both the working group and the ad hoc advisory group that we've convened. You did receive a supplemental handout that lists the working group and ad hoc group members, and I think you'll see from looking at that, we've convened a very diverse group of individuals representing many different interests, ranging from state and federal agencies to some local jurisdictions, also the private sector interests, conservation organizations, and finally landowners in Oregon. And as we were developing the working group process, we felt it was quite important to have these diverse interests represented at the table to ensure that whatever recommendations ultimately emerge from the working group really do address the diversity of needs related to individuals who would be involved in ecosystem services markets. And those range from regulatory agencies agencies to potential buyers of ecosystem services credits, such as developers who are mitigating or offsetting their impacts, to the landowners who would actually be providing ecosystem services credits through restoration and conservation work on the ground, and also conservation organizations and interests who are quite concerned with the long-term maintenance and protection of Oregon's natural resources. So hence, we do have a large working group that we feel like the composition is right to address the diversity of needs related to ecosystem services market development. Second, I'd like to highlight for you that the working group has identified four priority policy areas that they're delving into. Those are listed at the bottom of the first page of the interim update document. And the deliberations to date have been organized around these four policy issue areas, and ultimately the recommendations will be thematically organized around those. They include overarching goals for ecosystem services markets, agency processes, financing issues, and lastly, development of standards and methodologies for use in an integrated ecosystem services marketplace. And briefly, I'd just like to give you a sense of where the working group is in their process. They first convened in December of 2009, and since that time, they've been gathering information and really evaluating what is and is not working related to ecosystem services markets in Oregon, and also contemplating how a market-based approach could potentially benefit the state by producing both positive economic benefits to landowners and also positive ecological outcomes for all Oregon. And the state itself charged with statutorily protecting natural resources. In June, so actually just in a few weeks, we'll begin drafting the final report and recommendations from the working group, and we expect to finalize that process by the fall. We would then advance our final report and recommendations to the Sustainability Board for review and approval at their November meeting. And at that point, the Sustainability Board will advance the final report and recommendations to the legislature in advance of the start of the 2011 session. So we do today have three of the 513 working group members with us to provide some perspective from each of their organizations. And I guess at this point, I'll pass it over to Kathy McDonald from Nature Conservancy.
Great. Thank you. Chairs and members of the subcommittees, my name is Catherine McDonald. I'm the Director of Conservation Programs for the Nature Conservancy in Oregon and a member of Senate Bill 513 Working Group. The Nature Conservancy is pleased to be helping the state of Oregon develop policies and programs to restore ecosystem services and help advance a marketplace for private landowners who want to engage in conservation directly. More and more, we are seeing the consequences of failing to value the services that ecosystems provide to our mission, the conservation of biodiversity, but also to people and the places. And this is putting more and more lives at risk and also requiring more expensive fixes to address the fact that we haven't done a good job in the past of kind of incorporating an understanding of ecosystem services in our decision making. So we've been working here in Oregon and around the world to help develop information and tools that decision makers like you can use to make good land use decisions that will support and maintain those services where they're vital. One of those projects that we're working on is the Natural Capital Project. It's a cooperative project with Stanford University and World Wildlife Fund. And some of the work that has really formed the base of that effort was based on research right here in the Willamette Valley done by Oregon State University and others. We've also worked very closely with the Willamette Partnership and with federal agencies on the County on the Environment project to develop and test methods for documenting ecosystem services. And in addition to better understanding services themselves, the Nature Conservancy has been a long supporter of market-based solutions to conservation issues, and as such, we support the development of a marketplace. And toward that end, the Sustainable 513 effort has been very important in terms of helping advance policies that will streamline the way that we approach compensatory mitigation and other kinds of investments in ecosystem service protection. It's particularly important in a place like the Willamette where we're really kind of at a tipping point and our conservation efforts are not fast enough to make up for the amount of conservation that needs to be done in a short period of time, anticipating changes that will be coming down the road with climate change and with increasing populations in the valley. And so with trying to support a marketplace, we're very interested in helping to frame and structure the marketplace so it produces the highest quality conservation, long-term ecological benefits, that it targets resources the most effectively so we get the biggest outcome for the investments that we make, that it complements and adds value to the great programs that Oregon already has to advance conservation goals, and that it is a very transparent and accountable and credible system so that the public has confidence in the marketplace. And it's simple enough to engage landowners and others that are interested in participating in the marketplace. So those are all important aspects from our perspective of how a marketplace should be structured. As has been said earlier, Oregon's really being seen as a leader in the development of ecosystem service policies and marketplace efforts. And we want to thank you and your colleagues for passing Senate Bill 513, and think it's really just the first step in hopefully a long-term effort to try and better address and understand how the importance of ecosystems and how they support communities so that we can make the best decisions in the long run. Thank you.
All right, my turn. Chris Jarmer, Oregon Forest Industries Council. Glad to be here. Thanks for the time. Want to just point out, in 2009, we supported Senate Bill 513, testified in support, and I think we found out this morning that if anybody thought we were in recovery, we probably aren't, and if there's anything good about being in the recession today, for us, it means that we're not in the depression that we were in 2009. Our members have laid off a lot of employees. They've cut back salaries. They've cut back benefits significantly in some cases. It's been a really bad couple of years. And so in 2009, this idea of ecosystem services was floating around, and it became very obvious that if it was possible, any predictable stream of revenue would be beneficial to the landowners, and that might be a way to survive some of these more really turbulent times of our basic economic pattern, which is selling logs and lumber. So we got on board, and we appreciate the work that everybody's done to date. Tom's been a good leader for us all. We've got some good facilitators. The diversity of the work group has not held the work group back. I think it's been very interesting to learn from Kathy, from the gentleman at ODOT who has to buy mitigation credits, how difficult their world is. And I think it's been good for us private landowners to see that there's probably some opportunities here. I don't know if it's going to be the silver bullet. I doubt if there's a big pot of gold at the end of this rainbow. But on the other hand, if there's anything there, it's better than what we had before. And if we can couple some conservation benefits along with some revenue that the landowners can realize, all the better. So appreciate everybody's hard work. And if it comes to something that we can really be proud of, that would be great. And we would have been remiss if we hadn't tried. One thing I do want to caution the fellow from ODOT and his life, it makes me shudder listening to him talk about the restrictions and all the complications that are part of his mitigation world. That's not going to work for private landowners. If it's complicated, if it's burdensome and expensive, that's just not going to work. So we're really looking for that place in the middle, and maybe we can even help that mitigation world, the wetland mitigation and the ODOT world, come to a center place where it's less expensive for them to do their business as well. So there's some hope there, and appreciate you guys passing the bill and keeping with us and hearing from us. That's all I have. So.
Great, thank you. Chairs, member of the committee, my name is Bobby Cochran. I'm the executive director of the Willamette Partnership, a conservation organization. And I'll speak a little bit with two hats, because just up until last month, I was also with Clean Water Services, the sewer and stormwater utility for Washington County. And so I think for us as the Willamette Partnership and for Clean Water Services, the reason that we got interested in this is if you look at any stream in the state of Oregon, there's one agency that's in charge of the fish in that stream. Somebody else is in charge of how much water is in that stream. Somebody else is in charge of the water quality of that stream. Someone else is in charge of the logs on the side of the stream, which makes it really hard to manage all of nature and all of a watershed at the same time. And so if you're looking at kind of Oregon's common sense approach to managing natural resources, that's not how we're going to deal with the next sets of problems. that we have to deal with. And so the example that we like to talk about, particularly at Clean Water Services, is we were faced with a regulation looking at temperature. The water coming out of the end of the sewer pipes is too hot. Fish don't like hot water. It's basically going to cost us $150 million to put refrigerators on the end of that pipes or require people to flush ice down the toilet. Neither of those options were very palatable. But basically taking a step out of the weeds and saying, what does the watershed really need? Well, it needs cool, clean water that are coming from natural systems with riparian vegetation actually watering the streams. So rather than spending that $150 million, Clean Water Services invested $4 to $5 million basically restoring 35 miles of streams. It generated revenue for farmers. It generated work in the urban area. And most of the people doing those jobs are displaced forest workers or off-season fire crews. So higher paying jobs, more consistent year-round work that are closer to homes and their families, which really starts to look at this role of ecosystem services as kind of a pillar of the green economy. If you look at some recent research from University of Oregon, restoration has an enormous economic multiplier for communities. It generates an enormous amount of jobs that are consistent over time. We really need to be thinking about this as an economic development strategy. And it's catching, what we're doing in Oregon is catching the attention of folks around the country. Secretary Vilsack at USDA has said ecosystem services is one of the four key pillars of USDA. And basically saying, looking at the Willamette, looking at Oregon as a leader in the country of how we're going to get this done, and a big part of that is the leadership that the legislature started today. And I think at the Willamette Partnership, we're a conservation organization looking at these markets and looking at them not just in the Willamette but around the Pacific Northwest. And as we're having conversations in the Klamath, in the Rogue, in the Walla Walla, in the Snake, there's an enormous amount of interest to folks saying, let's look at the money that we're spending on environmental compliance and conservation now, and how do we invest in the priorities that are going to get us as a state to where we want to go next? And in order to do that, people are asking, how do we get accountability to improve the quality of conservation? How do we get predictability so that we know if we're going to take an alternative approach to the status quo, we're not going to get flapped beside the head? And then also importantly, people are looking for choices and flexibility. And for me, trading and market-based approaches provide all of those things. And so I think the SB 513 working group is really looking at a way that when the Klamath or the Rogue want to do something, they don't have to start from scratch anymore. They don't have to go through all the capacity building that we've spent in the last 5 years in the Willamette Basin. And so I think that's really what we're looking at. And the role of government's going to be important, both in where government choose to actively say, these markets are important for Oregon's economy, and actively saying, we're going to step back and let the private sector take care of that section. So I think, you know, in terms of where we have a lot of the tools to make these markets work. I think the recommendations you're going to be seeing come out of SB 513 group are really about how do we take this into the next step to deliver environmental benefits, jobs, and kind of true sustainability for the state over time.
Well, appreciate the breadth of the presentation and the engagement from so many quarters in this process. It's heartening to hear that so much work has been done, and we're on a really good path, it seems. I wonder if members of the committees have questions for this set of panelists. Representative Pence?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am struck by the challenge your group faces in trying to make as broad a universe as you've described actually into something that we'll be able to do something with. And so perhaps you could share with us one thing that we might anticipate you bringing forward that we'll be looking at about a year from now. Have you gotten to the point where you can share one concept with us? And I'll just, the reason I find this of interest is because I have worked on conservation easements. I have worked on water right sales. I have worked on any number of other devices to try to accomplish the purposes you so eloquently outlined. But I am interested in how one draws all that together into a market, because my experience has been we have a long ways to go. That's what my experience has been. So I'm just curious what we might anticipate.
Mr. Chair, Chair's Representative Bence, that's a great question. I'll look to folks here in just a second. We actually have another meeting of the working group on Thursday, and that meeting is we've been in a winnowing down process because you're right. This is a big universe that we're trying to tackle, and we've been slowly, incrementally trying to crystallize this into some policy recommendations that can be useful for you. We're not there yet in terms of, I think, identifying specifics. My hope is by the end of this week we'll be in a much closer place, our intention has been to delegate responsibilities to a subset of working group members who will start writing the report and refining those policy recommendations. So unless another panelist here feels that there is something that's ripe enough to offer,
I would make a comment.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bence, a lot of times in my mind, defining the answer to a question often means finding out what the answer is not. And I think we've done a lot with what the answer isn't. And in my mind, that's real progress, because the work group pretty unanimously has taken further regulation off the table. The easiest way to create a market is to artificially do it via regulation. And that has been taken off the table, which I appreciate, because then we don't have to be as defensive. We don't have to worry about that part of, you know, keeping what you've got and trying not to lose in the situation. So in my mind, even if we don't come back with, you know, 16 legislative concepts, we've already made some progress in the larger community that I do appreciate. So maybe that's something that you can write down or not. It's an answer that didn't come up, which is good for our part of the world.
Hello, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. I would just say that I have found in dealing with a lot of these transfers and other devices that Oregon already has an awful lot of solutions to some of these problems that lots of other states do not. And so one way or the other, we were generally able in my law practice to get done what we were trying to do. So I think you have a good foundation to build upon, but it may be that you have less to do than might have otherwise been the case, given Oregon's advanced, I choose to call that, current position. Good luck. We'll look forward to the report.
Great.
Well, thanks very much for the presentation, and we will all look forward to the report and possible recommendations for action in 2011.
Thank you for your time.
Thanks.
Thank you.
We're going to switch gears again and spend a few minutes with Angus Duncan, Chair of the Global Warming Commission, who I asked to provide us a bit of an update on that entity and its recent and projected work.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chairman Haas, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to linger in Salem. I appreciate it always. My name is Angus Duncan. I'm chair of the Oregon Global Warming Commission. And in my day job, I'm president of the Bonneville Environmental Foundation. I mention that because I can't let this prior panel pass without just observing how encouraging I find that. And I speak as someone who has been in the business of buying and selling and trading environmental services now for about 10 years. You know, we have built an Oregon business. It employs 30 people and has revenues of $8 to $10 million a year. And those are primarily in the buying and selling of renewable energy credits, of carbon credits, and we now have a water credit product that we have put out on the market. So we're very much believers that, you know, that there is a balanced relationship between sort of necessary regulation to set minimum public value thresholds and the potential for drawing additional environmental values into the marketplace and finding people who are willing to invest in them. And we've been successful, so I'm very glad to see that process underway. I'm here to speak to you about the activities and the progress of the Global Warming Commission. When I was here last, I delivered our report from last year, which observed that having set
as a state having set greenhouse gas reduction goals back in 2004, the legislature having adopted those in 2007, that we were on track to meet our first goal, which was to arrest the greenhouse gas emissions growth creep of about 1% a year since 1990, to flatten that line and to bend it back downwards. And as of this year, we don't have final inventory figures back in, but it's pretty clear that we are going to hit that goal. And that's terrific. It's encouraging, but it also allows us then to turn our attention to our next 2020 goal, which is a far more substantial lift. The state adopted a 2020 goal of being 10% below 1990 levels by 2020. That's roughly equivalent to about a 30% reduction from emissions levels of today, and we would have to achieve that in the face of a expected population growth of somewhere between 10 and 12% over the next 10 years. So that's a fairly major lift, and we will not get there if we don't start planning on that today and ultimately don't start legislating on that today. So I have provided you with a one-page cover memo and then a more detailed discussion of the Roadmap to 2020 project that the Global Warming Commission has agreed to undertake to try to identify the kinds of actions that we will need to begin to legislate or begin to invest in to get to that 2020 goal. And I'm going to walk you just very briefly through that cover memo if I can. We are going to look at trying to assess the magnitude of reductions, not just overall, but we're going to try to disaggregate those reductions so that we have a better sense for where, our best targets of opportunity are. We will look, as usual, at the sources of emissions, the fuels and the end users that produce emissions. But we're also going to try to look at geography, see if we can break out emissions by different parts of the state so that we have a better sense for which parts of the state have what opportunities to reduce. And we're going to try to look at this for the first time based on the embedded carbon associated with goods that we bring into the state and with what we do with those goods, their use and ultimately their disposal. It's a very substantial part of our carbon footprint, and the work we've done so far only looks at that embedded carbon in the form of the electricity we import from Wyoming and Montana. We don't look at it in the form of the television sets we import from China and Japan, and so we need to start doing that. We will try to look at the costs, the relative costs of reducing those emissions so that we develop as efficient a plan as possible. We'll look at timing. It's entirely possible that we'll find out that throwing a lot of money at one area doesn't produce emissions reductions between now and 2020, whereas as investing less money but more strategically allows us to describe a ramp that gets us to significant reductions, maybe not by 2020, particularly in transportation and land use, but by 2025 or 2030. If you think, for example, of the timing that will be required to start ramping in electric vehicles into our existing internal combustion fleet, it's hard to see that we will make a huge dent in our automobile emissions from vehicles by 2020. We may make significant reductions by reducing vehicle miles traveled, but urban design, urban planning, and the substitution of vehicle technologies, those are probably longer term turnaround investments that we're going to have to, but we're going to have to start making the decisions to hit that ramp and start moving up it today if we want to realize the benefits in 2025 or 2030. If that's the case, then we have to find extra savings elsewhere between now and 2020. That's probably in the utilities and the energy efficiency realm. But again, we have to identify where those are. But we have more of a running start, I guess, at getting the reductions on the utility side and in energy efficiency. We need to look at equity effects of these reductions, at what parts of our population, what parts of our economy are liable to carry disproportionately heavy cost loads, and how we manage those transitions. So we will look at, we'll go back and revisit inventory. We will look at particularly energy efficiency, since that's not only one of the earliest opportunities for savings, but that's probably the one where we will realize cost savings early that we can roll over against other reductions. That probably is one of those areas where we need to look particularly at equity impacts on low-income households, who will have access to the kind of capital for, you know, for retrofitting their home. That access will be tougher for them. It'll be harder for them to get a loan. So how do we make sure that they don't get hammered by higher energy prices without the means to reduce their energy consumption? We want to start a look at industrial emissions. You know, this is actually probably the other equity or distributional impact issue that we've identified, in addition to low-income households. And it's odd to put those two demographics together. But a number of the industries, especially the high energy intensity industries that operate in this state, that would be pulp and paper, wood products, steel, some chemicals, some other metals. Those are mostly cement. Those are industries that are largely price takers in national or in some cases global markets, so they don't have a lot of opportunities to pass higher costs along. How do we make sure that they have the opportunity to get access to investment capital to improve the efficiency of both their energy consumption and their processes? I've already discussed transportation, so I won't linger on that. I mean, the transportation strategies are, well, I may come back to that if we have time, Mr. Chair. We want to, and we will, we'll mobilize technical subcommittees to look at forestry and at agriculture, where there are both opportunities for emissions reduction, and where there are adaptation impacts that need to be dealt with, and where the carbon tracking and accounting issues are particularly difficult, vexing. There are folks globally who are still trying to figure out how you measure the embedded carbon and the protected carbon in a forest, and we haven't succeeded altogether in doing that here in Oregon yet. There is a state agency adaptation task force chaired by the Department of Land Conservation and Development that most state agency directors are parties to, as am I, as is Dr. Moat from the Climate Change Institute. Dr. Moat will be delivering by the end of this year an assessment of the current state of knowledge of impacts of climate change on the state of Oregon. The Adaptation Committee is going to try to respond to that by describing the kinds of actions or interventions that we need to take as state policy in order to try to cushion the impacts of those changes. Forest fire, flood, drought, you know, the litany of you know, climate unpleasantness that we are going to be having to deal with. There are two or three other pieces to this. We are going to try to have a public review of the recommendations, as we did when it drew very substantial interest all across the state. People showing up at the hearings, you know, people writing letters. This is back when people wrote letters on paper, and so we could actually measure the impact of the proposals that we were offering. So the one other thing that I wanted to try to do here today, Mr. Chairman, is to leave you with a sense for the kinds of measures and the scale of measures that we will need to deal with. We're going to try to look at this pathway to 2020 not just as a path that stops at 2020, but we'll try to look at it starting backwards at 2050 and working backwards so that we see just what kinds of not just incremental but really transformational changes we will have to be thinking about so that we get a start on those in the next 10 years. So let me just give you a little bit of the flavor of that, and then, Mr. Chair, I will I'll conclude, and if there are questions, we can talk about those. Between now and 2020, and it may be December 31st, 2020, but between now and 2020, we will probably be closing the only coal plant in the state of Oregon, Boardman. Portland General Electric has put a closure by 2020 on the table. It's being discussed at the PUC, at the Environmental Quality Commission, you know, by our commission members, and obviously by any number of stakeholders. At least right now, the proposal to replace it is with gas baseload combustion turbines with some additional wind and additional energy efficiency. But the predominant substitution would be gas combustion turbine for pulverized coal combustion. That may be okay between now and 2020, but by 2050, we need to have thought about basically either converting the entire coal fleet to a carbon capture and storage fleet, and frankly, that's unlikely based on the slow progression of that technology and the very high cost. Or we will need to simply close those plants and replace them with something. And I won't, there are any number of options for that. The sort of immediate one that members of Congress gravitate to, because it involves, you know, big discrete plants, is nuclear. And I, as a student of this, think nuclear needs to be on the table. But frankly, when you look at the costs associated with nuclear, they are comparable to and as daunting as the costs associated with carbon capture and storage. So I don't think we need to rule nuclear off the table. I think we simply need to look clearly at what's the cost-effective way to take coal out of the equation. And I say cost-effective, I don't say easy, because we're probably talking about a very substantial transformation of our generation fleet from one which is predominantly fossil fuel to one where fossil fuel is still a part of it, but the fossil fuel part of it, it serves more an integrating function than it does a baseload function. So we're looking at a coal generation system which is seeing wind penetration rates at levels that right now give electrical engineers serious nightmares, but which we think are clearly doable if we are smart about the integrating strategies, about bringing additional storage into the system, both at the generation end out in Wyoming and at the consumption end in your garage or in your basement. So we're talking about up to or exceeding 25% penetration rates for wind. We now in this region are at about 8%. We're talking about hydro staying at about the same level it is today. So solar, biomass, and natural gas make up the other 25%, but the natural gas functions as an integrating resource and not a baseload resource. That is a complete transformation from the kind of generation strategies we have followed for the better part of the last 100 years. Energy efficiency is right now the third largest source of electricity in this region. Now, we don't see it because when we do energy efficiency, we don't include a wedge for that, but if we did, it would be at about 12% since 1980. Very substantial and by far the least expensive source of energy that we have available to us, and a source where technology keeps evolving almost faster than those of us in the business can keep track of it. You know, you probably thought if you were starting to replace or even finishing replacing your incandescents with your compact fluorescents that you were doing good work, and you are, but compact fluorescents are very quickly going to be yesterday's technology. LEDs are supposed to be the next technology on the horizon, but frankly there are at least two steps beyond LEDs that are at the point where they are entering demonstration phase as a preface to commercialization. So LEDs may only be with us for a short period of time before even more efficient lighting technologies are available. And I can replicate that story in a lot of different areas where the opportunities for dealing with lighting, with water heating, with space heating, with plug loads. You know, the opportunities are, as we say about energy efficiency, it's the tree where you pluck the low-hanging fruit and it keeps growing back. And I think we can count on that, but we also have to continue to incent it. Within the transportation land use area, the strategy fundamentally is vehicle miles per traveled have to keep declining, as they have been since about the year 2000 within the Portland metro area, and they've been relatively flat statewide. Electric vehicles or other low-carbon vehicles, but probably EVs, are the vehicle propulsion choice of at least the next 10 or 20 years. We have to couple those with increased investments in transit, in urban design that created more walkable neighborhoods, and fundamentally that create the kinds of densities, especially within an urban growth boundary and along transit lines, that will support not just transit, not just bicycles, but also electric vehicles. The denser the urban area, the more likely folks are to switch from internal combustion to electric vehicle and still not feel, you know, the affliction of the moment approaching, which is something called range anxiety. Will I run out of electricity if I hop in my electric vehicle and go to the store? Well, that can be addressed both by vehicle technology and by density, so that you don't have to drive 150 miles and worry about running out of electricity.
I guess we're about out of time.
Good. I am about done. I think those were the... Oh, the one other example I wanted to give, because we tend to sort of slip by this, is we tend to think about most of these opportunities as urban opportunities, and frankly, most of them, the ones that involve efficiency, are. The sort of division of responsibility is that we have to get more efficient in urban areas, and we have to develop more renewables in rural areas in this state. But there is a tendency to think of electric vehicles as a prototypical urban vehicle, whereas I think what we will see is increased opportunities for farm vehicles to be electrically driven, and that will actually create not just carbon savings, but vastly more convenience and probably, you know, more lifting and carrying capabilities on ranches. You no longer have to drive into town to fill up to refill your diesel tank on the farm. You just plug into your electrical outlet. So we think, if we are clever about this, that there are a lot of different opportunities. There's a lot of upside to solving this problem, as well as the usual sort of grim downside. Mr. Chair, thank you very much.
Well, that's a good note to end on. Angus, appreciate your far-reaching and, you know, future-oriented look into the state. See if there are any quick questions. Yeah, Representative Bernhardt.
Thank you. You've pointed out, and of course we know, that conservation is one of the big items on in this whole area. Although I appreciate the presentation and all of the things you've said. I'm wondering if, as we look further at conservation, we also are looking at lifestyle issues. I'm thinking about housing size, a whole variety of other issues, telecommuting, and so on and so on and so on. Can we get that number up?
You want bigger houses?
No. The conservation number up, and maybe I put it the other way around. Mm-hmm. Utilization per capita down.
Mm-hmm.
And if so, can we do this synergistically? Can we make these things work together to do it for us? And what are the, if you can do it briefly, what are the plans going ahead for that kind of activity?
So I have another 30 minutes, right, Mr. Chair? No. So that's actually why I tried to spend a couple of minutes on the urban transportation package, because those pieces really do have to operate synergistically.
Yeah.
We can't accelerate electric vehicle market penetration if we don't create the kinds of opportunities for, you know, not just, you know, driving, but recharging that a relatively dense urban area will provide. You get higher densities if you also drop
drop dwelling size. And we actually have started to see, particularly in the Portland area, a shift back into a denser downtown core. And actually, if you look at where both the energy intensity and the foreclosure rates have occurred, not just in the Portland area, but nationwide, you find that there are higher costs, higher carbon emissions, and far higher foreclosure rates in urban areas that have more sprawl. So we've saved significant money and dislocation and a lot of other things by thinking about urban design in exactly the kind of non-fragmented way, strategic way you're talking about.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I'm cognizant on that efficiency question. You just think of household electrical use, that some of the gains that we make are offset by the new technologies that come into our lives. So I may replace every, and have replaced every incandescent bulb with a fluorescent, but I also got one of those nifty smartphones, and when I plug that into charge, that's a new drain on my, that's new power that I'm using. And similarly with set boxes on televisions and so on and so forth. I mean, there are a lot of electrical uses that we need to be vigilant about. We certainly have to continue as a legislature, I believe, to set the kinds of standards for those new appliances coming into our lives to ensure that all the good work that we're doing on efficiency are not offset by new sources of electrical use.
The fastest growing electrical load we have in the country is that collection called plug loads. They are TV sets and hair dryers and your phone, and those are the fastest growing sets of loads. And I think that there is not a regulatory way to preclude that kind of innovation. I'm not at all sure we want to preclude it, but what we do want to do is channel it. And I have not spent any time today talking about carbon caps, and I will not spend much because it can be a long, drawn out and contentious discussion. But I will just say this, that I am a supporter of those, preferably nationally, and the reason is not because I think we need or want a mechanical crank that cranks down on carbon loads, which is mostly the way people think of a carbon cap. What we really want is something that sets a completely different signal and sends that signal out to manufacturers, to inventors, to the guy who's going to do the next lighting technology or think about the next television technology, and say, if you come up with a lighting or a television technology that uses substantially less energy and therefore produces less carbon, you'll make a bundle of money. If you come up with one that looks a lot like the carbon and energy profiles of technology today, you're on a losing path. And that's what a long-term declining carbon cap gives us, is a signal that really sets the imaginations free, the innovators and the commercializers.
Thanks very much, Angus. I got so excited about being on time through 3:30 that I lost track of time in the final half an hour, and so we are going to carry on, and members who can stay, please do. We'll get a update on Portland Harbor efforts, and do we have Dick, you're going to... No, you're turning it over.
Jim Anderson.
Okay. Jim Anderson and Don Pyle.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Jensen.
It's striking, I'm dawning on me, that I may have found, as you're dealing with this topic, the solution to the 55 mile an hour speed limit.
What's that?
And that's forming a company, which I'd welcome you to be a part of, where we'll buy the carbon saving, from those individuals who adhere to the 55 miles an hour, and then we can sell that to, all those who want to either go 110 miles an hour or to some industry that wants to use more carbon than they would normally be allowed to.
So in the place of speed limits, we'll have speed cap and trade.
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Well,
maybe we'll
find a way to get to the 55 mile an hour.
We'll find a way to get this deal through here,
after
even
all.
If the leadership is not real crazy about that idea.
Work on it.
My experience is Representative Jensen doesn't let the posted speed get in his way. It's a suggestion.
Sorry.
Gentlemen, what order do you want to take it in?
I'll go ahead and start. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jim Anderson. I'm a manager at DEQ, Department of Environmental Quality. I'm managing the Portland Harbor section up in our northwest region in Portland. What I wanted to do was to give you an update on Portland Harbor. Don Pyle, sitting to my left with the Department of Justice, will talk about allocation and natural resource damage. I have about 16 slides to go through, and I'll try to make this pretty quick. I'll leave time for questions if there are any. Again, what I'd like to do is just give you a general overview, status, what the next steps and the schedule are. I'm not going to go through a lot of background on Portland Harbor. Okay, there we go. Thank you. This is a map of Portland Harbor. Downtown Portland is in the southern portion, the bottom of the slide. And Portland Harbor is really river mile, essentially 2 to river mile, almost 12. It's about a 10-mile stretch. And it's the study area. It's not the site yet. Portland Harbor site, in EPA's parlance, won't be defined until the record decision in a couple more years. The site will include the footprint of contamination in water, since this site was listed as a sediment contamination site, that is the sand and mud at the bottom of the river, and the sources of contamination in the uplands or upstream that are controlled by the end of the project. Okay, there's 5 components that we'll talk about today in Portland Harbor. I'm going to talk about the first 3, the RIFS, the Remedial Investigation Feasibility Study, Source Control, In-Water Early Action, and Don Pyle will talk about NERDA, Natural Resource Damage Assessment, and Allocation. This is a pretty busy slide, but the purpose of this slide is to really show all the players that are involved in this project. There's 2 major efforts going on. There's CERCLA Superfund up here, and then the natural resource damage here. Those are the 2 main efforts. And the state is participating from a technical end, helping out in the in-water RFS, that's DEQ, and we're also supporting ODF&W as part of the NERDA assessment. There's some potential state liability that Don Pyle will talk about, and that's down here as part of state lands, perhaps ODOT being a potential responsible party as far as the NERDA claims, and also here under the other RPs, responsible parties, we could have some state liability for CERCLA. Well, everyone's interested in what the Portland Harbor RFS schedule is, and here's what it pretty much is. There's about 4 things that will happen. In the fourth quarter of this year, we expect to finalize the remedial investigation and risk assessments. We've got a draft risk assessment in now. We're completing our review of that. It's an EPA lead project. DEQ is supporting EPA along with 6 tribes and a number of other natural resource trustees. The next step will be about this time next year, about the second quarter of 2011, when the Lower Willamette Group, which is the responsible party that's doing this Superfund project, that's responsible for this Superfund project, will submit a draft feasibility study. And a feasibility study is simply looking at the potential remedies that could be implemented to clean up the site. In the third quarter, about a quarter later, EPA will begin to prepare the record decision, the ROD. And we expect the record decision to come out in late 2012, perhaps pushed off a quarter or two, but we're expecting and we're managing towards a late 2012 record decision. And what happens after 2012, after the record decision? Then we go into what's called RDRA, which is Remedial Design and Remedial Action. And I wanted to make just one point on that. You know, this is a sediment cleanup site, the sand and the mud, bottom of the river. What's going to happen is either dredging, capping, or monitored natural recovery. And through those actions, the fish tissue that's impacted should clean up. Surface water that's impacted as it flows through the harbor should clean up. We're not going to filter the Willamette River water, and we're not going to obviously scrub fish or anything. It's going to be a sediment cleanup and a source control action whereas the fish and the water column should respond to those actions. I'd like to go into source control now, the second of the three topics I want to talk about. This is an interactive map that's on our DEQ website. It's interactive in that you can click on any of these little sites here. These are all names of facilities in our upland, and you can go into our ECSI database and find out who the project manager is, where we are in the project. It's a very popular map for folks to use on the DEQ website. The status of upland source control, well, really the focus and the purpose of source control is the last thing anybody wants to see in this project is for the Lower Willamette Group or any other responsible parties to implement a very expensive sediment remedy and have that sediment remedy fouled by an uncontrolled upland source, whether it's stormwater or groundwater or bank erosion or anything else. So what we're trying to do at DEQ, besides working on the in-water RFS, is we're trying to control those upland sources of contamination so they don't pose risk and they don't pose that contamination potential. We've got about 90 sites that we're working on or have worked on in Portland Harbor. About 22 of those sites have been completed. Source control decisions have been made, and we either have a source control measure in place or we feel that there's not a source threat there. What our focus is on source control is really the 16 high priority sites in Portland Harbor. We have interim source control measures done in about 11 of those sites. And our goal is to have these sites controlled by the time of the record decision in late 2012. Oops. I want to just have one slide here on upriver source control. What I've been talking about is the upland source control, and that's really the sites that are adjacent to Portland Harbor on both sides of the river that could be contributing to contamination in the river. There's three upriver actions that are going on. Perhaps the biggest site is the Seidel site. It's a barge building site under the Ross Island Bridge in South Waterfront area. It has a long history of industrial use. A lot of contamination there, PCBs, metals, degraded petroleum hydrocarbon, and so on. The upland remedy should be implemented, or at least started to be implemented this summer through this year. And then the in-water capping, which will be the in-water remedy, should take place next summer. The second of the three efforts is in the downtown reach. And the downtown reach is really from the Fremont Bridge to about Ross Island. It's that stretch of the Lower Willamette River that's upstream of Portland Harbor. DEQ is working with the City of Portland and a number of other responsible parties to do kind of a mini RIFS, Portland Harbor RIFS of this downtown reach, to make sure we understand what the sources are so they don't pose a recontamination potential threat. And the last one is one particular project that PGE is doing under DEQ oversight. It's at the OMSI site, the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry, Old Station L. It's a number of PGE properties where they had PCB releases. So we're working to investigate and clean those sites up. Well, the last of the three things I was going to talk about in Portland Harbor are these early actions. And an early action is an EPA lead project, and it should be an in-water project. And it is an in-water project. An early action site is a site that has contamination at a pretty high level, and it has a threat of growing larger through through erosion and transport, migration, or one thing or another. There are sites that should have some type of remedial action done before the final remedy is implemented after the record decision. There's three early action sites going on in Portland Harbor. The first one is the Port of Portland's Terminal 4, which is located just downstream. It's working real well. It's such a small map. It's located downstream of the St. John's Bridge at about River Mile 4. It's one of the port's larger marine terminals. It's where the Toyotas are offloaded and stored for distribution there. What we have at Terminal 4 is degraded petroleum hydrocarbons, coal tar, PCBs, metals, kind of typical of Portland Harbor. And what we have planned for early action is the three things that we have that we're looking at in the feasibility study: dredging, capping, and monitor natural recovery. There's one other thing going on in Terminal 4, and that is a confined disposal facility. This is an aerial view looking south, down towards the railroad bridge, which is there, and the St. John's Bridge, which this thing is failing on me, right in the middle there. So the Terminal 4 is that crosshatched area, And what the port is planning on doing is putting in a CDF, a confined disposal facility, which would accept contaminated sediments. And it would be in that lowermost berth, berth one, or not berth, but slip, slip one here. This is a schematic of that CDF. You can see at this bottom caption, that's the same photograph on the bottom right-hand side, that's that same aerial photograph we saw. Slip one is that largest of the three slips, and there's a cross-section at the very bottom also that kind of depicts this CDF, this confined disposal facility. So the port would plan to take sediments from their site and from other sites in Portland Harbor that would be suitable for disposal here, so they wouldn't be susceptible to erosion, they wouldn't be susceptible to dissolution through dissolving, and maintain them there as a disposal facility. Cap over the top of it and use it for a marine terminal facility. The second early action is Gasco site, which is located essentially across the river from Terminal 4. It's just upstream of the St. John's Bridge. And Gasco is a Northwest Natural site. It was a manufactured gas plant site in the early 1900s that shut down, I think, in the 1950s. And the contaminant there is coal tar, degraded petroleum hydrocarbons or polynuclear aromatic hydrocarbons. It's a pretty big site with pretty big contamination. And there's actually been two early actions that have happened at Gasco. What you're looking at here is the shoreline, and all that spongy-looking brown material is actually coal tar right along the beach area at Gasco, and that's just a portion of the contamination there. The uplands are contaminated pretty heavily, and the in-water is also contaminated pretty heavily. But in 2005, EPA oversaw Northwest Natural removing about 15,000 tons of this tar, hauling it to Arlington for a proper disposal. EPA also signed a second in-water early action with Gasco, and the design there is really to go ahead and do the remedial design so that when the Portland Harbor Record of Decision is signed in about 2012, they'll have already done the remedial design and be ready to go out in water and do the final remedy shortly after the Record Decision. The third and the last site, early action site, is the Arkema site, also known as Atafina or Penwall, Pensalt. Those of you that lived in Portland for a while can remember this site. It's where piles of salt, white salt, were stockpiled. That's their feedstock. It's just directly upstream from the railroad bridge, directly upstream from Gasco on the west side of the river. Well, Arkema, and there's an aerial photograph from the 1990s. You can see the salt piles at the very bottom right-hand side. Arkema, it was a chloralkaline plant. They produced pesticides, DDT in particular, perchlorate, sulfuric acid, a number of chloralkaline products. It's a vacant site right now. It's not being operated, and all the buildings that you see there have been demolished except for their administrative building. You know, it's a bad site for Portland Harbor. It's a pesticide manufacturing facility that directly discharged into the river, and we have groundwater and upland issues. This is the third early action site, and we haven't made as much progress on this site as we'd like to for one reason or another, but we're moving forward trying to get this site in the queue as far as sediment remedies sooner rather than later. I think EPA is taking a first-worst type philosophy for looking at these sites. This is one of the most contaminated sites in the harbor. And with that, I'll turn it over to Don Pyle. I'm not really sure how to... Sue, can you change to his... Should I just escape here and... Thank you.
Good afternoon, chairs and committee members. My name is Don Pyle. I'm an assistant attorney general with the Oregon Department of Justice. My job there is to coordinate the state's legal interests in Portland Harbor Superfund. As Jim has mentioned,
That's a lot of different elements. He's covered the science part, which is a hard part. The legal part is a hard part also. The state's involved in the Superfund through five state agencies, DEQ, handling the upland cleanup and the source control, Department of State Lands, which is a potentially liable party for certain activities I'll cover, ODOT, again a potentially liable party, ODFW is the state's trustee on the Natural Resource Trustee Council, and DOJ is representing all of those agencies on these elements. I'll go right to the money issue that faces the state, these potential state fiscal risks down the road coming out of the Superfund process. And I'll talk about these separately. This slide just covers the three major ones. First up is the percentage share of liability for investigation and cleanup costs in Portland Harbor. Those cleanup costs and RIFS costs will be allocated among all the liable parties at the end of the day. The current cost level of the RIFS, the investigation that's gone on for the last 9 years, the money spent by the performing parties doing that investigation, $77 million. It's one of, if not the most expensive Superfund investigation in national history. So there's a lot of science that's been accumulated. As far as cleanup costs, the actual cost to dredge, cap, or watch what's going on, there's an estimate out there by the U.S. Department of Justice from EPA saying that $1 billion is a reasonable number for the cleanup costs. So that's the first fiscal risk that the state may have some part of. Second is the percentage share of natural resource damages. This is another potential risk for the state. Natural resource damages, as I'll explain, are also a claim allowed for under CERCLA and other federal acts. We also have our own state counterpart. And so if there is liability on state agency part, we'll have a percentage share of that cost as well. What is that cost? It's not really known, but in a bankruptcy proceeding, the U.S. Department of Justice filed some papers putting that number at $650 million. Now, whether that's accurate, no one knows, but that's a number that's been filed in court. The third major element is a statutory fiscal element that comes with every Superfund process, and that's what's called the 10% cost share that every state must pay to also share in whatever EPA settlement is for the orphan share, and I'll explain what that means. So what are the state activities that cause these potential risks? For ODOT, as you know, owns highways. They also own outfalls in the Portland Harbor. So stormwater that hits the roads is directed through ODOT-owned piping through six outfalls that discharge into Portland Harbor. And the reason they're doing that, of course, is for safety reasons, to remove rainwater hazard from highways. Well, incidentally, that rainwater picks up all the drips from our automobiles and also air deposition as well. So contaminants from cars, from the air, accumulate in the rainwater and go through the outfalls into the harbor. That is a potential category that causes ODOT to be a potential liable party. Department of State Lands, as you know, manages the state-owned banks and beds of our waterways, so they own the beds and banks of the entire harbor. They undertake proprietary activities. They lease activities on the land, docks. They have easements. And so activities that occur on DSL-owned land, as the owner or a lessor, they have potential liability under Superfund laws for those activities, even though they didn't undertake them themselves, activities that cause contamination.
So for both ODOT and DSL, it's in the nature of derivative liability. This slide just goes through the liability elements for a Superfund action. In the context of this allocation of costs, the state faces liability perhaps under the state Superfund, but not under federal. We're protected under the 11th Amendment from lawsuits by private parties under CERCLA. EPA could sue us directly, but in the context of an allocation, we'll be looking at state Superfund law. Those are the basic elements listed there. We have statutory defenses to liability that we're working on diligently and will raise in any kind of allocation proceeding. The allocation of costs, again, is this division of the pie of remedial action costs. And there, the court or whoever is performing the allocation will look at a number of factors that are listed in our state statute, ranging from how much you discharged hazardous substances, how toxic they were, what was your involvement in the release, what's the relative culpability of the party releasing those hazardous substances, your cooperation with the government, and so forth. You can see there's quite a list here. All of those factors are considered, and that's how the allocator cuts up the pie. Where are we today in, for this allocation process? Well, there is a process underway. The state is participating through ODOT and DSL. It's a private process. It's confidential. It's being conducted in accordance with Oregon mediation law, which, as you know, provides a shield, a confidentiality shield that will lead to a non-judicial dispute resolution. But that's all I can really say because of the confidentiality strictures. The 10% cost share risk that I mentioned, the way this works, as a private settlement, EPA has a policy they can offer something to the liable parties to encourage them to come to EPA with a big number that will cover the cleanup costs. They can forgive up to 25% of whatever orphan share comes out of a site. The orphan share are all the sites that are either defunct, industries operated and they're gone either because they've disappeared or they've gone into bankruptcy. So in the allocation, those sites will get a share of that pie, but they're orphans. Now of that amount, however big that piece is, the EPA can forgive 25%, take that on themselves as a prod to the PRPs. But CERCLA requires the state to then pay EPA 10% of that share. So you can see with the way the numbers work out here, if cleanup costs are $1 billion, any percentage orphan share of that number is going to be a big number, and 10% of that number will also be a big number. So that's that risk for the state. I've just listed here two websites, DEQ's website and EPA's website on Portland Harbor. If you're interested in following the course of this over the next 5 years, these websites are updated and contain all the pertinent documents and information. I'll just briefly address the natural resource damage element now. This is a picture of the harbor. As you can see, this shows the harbor as it flows through the city and through the industries. There isn't a lot of areas depicted there for protection of species using the harbor. It's pretty well armored, bulkheaded, and docked up. The authorities for natural resource damage claim come out of CERCLA and OPA, which is the Oil Pollution Act. A party is responsible if they're liable for damages for injury to, destruction, or loss of natural resources. The cost of assessing those injuries as well. So what does a natural resource damage claim add to the CERCLA process? You can look at it, the usual example of a spill in a stream, for example. The oil hits the water, it damages resources, the sediments, it damages the fauna and creatures using that river area. The remediation comes in under CERCLA and cleans up to whatever degree that cleanup levels require.
and natural recovery will come back someday. NRD comes in behind that remediation. It looks at restoring or replacing the natural resources to the pre-contamination level before the spill occurred. And it seeks to recover compensation damages for the loss of use of those injured resources from the time of the spill until the time of recovery. So that's how NRD works. The Portland Harbor NRD is composed of a trustee council. The representatives on the federal side are NOAA and U.S. Fish and Wildlife. And that's the Department of Commerce and Department of Interior. Five tribes are also on the trustee council: Siletz, Nez Perce, Umatilla, Warm Springs, and Grand Ronde. And as I mentioned, the state's trustee is ODFW. The trustees have undertaken a four-phase approach here to bring in the NRD claim. They're trying to do something very novel, and that's a cooperative assessment with the potentially liable parties rather than just moving right into litigation level act stage. We're trying to work out a settlement process. This slide discusses the four phases. Phase one is now essentially complete. The trustees developed an assessment plan, a how-to, and what they should look at in terms of assessing injury to natural resources in the harbor. Phase two will start this summer. Phase two is a settlement-oriented action plan, which is intended to lead to an ultimate settlement of NRD liability for parties who agreed to participate and fund that particular phase. So the trustees in phase two will do an assessment of injuries. They'll do an allocation of damages, which will, in some senses, mirror the allocation on the remedial side with some tweaks, and then engage in a settlement process. For parties who do not settle in phase two, that will be taken up in phase three. The trustees will do a full-blown litigation level NRDA assessment, which with all the scientists and so forth. And phase four will be litigation against those parties who don't settle. This is just a graph process overview of the NRD process that takes you through it from phase one in the middle here to phase two, the estimates and settlements through allocation to settlement, phase three. These are just some slides on background on NRD, the types of resources, who can make the claim, what is an injury to natural resource, that's any kind of measurable adverse change in the chemical or physical quality or viability of the natural resource.
And Mr. Pyle, if you could wrap it up here.
I will.
Thanks.
So the trustees will move ahead with these assessments. One area is we're looking at is a navigational service assessment on behalf of the state and the federal trustees. And at the end of the day, what the trustees are looking for is to not collect money per se, but actually have the PRPs undertake restoration projects to offset the losses to injured resources with actual projects that represent a benefit that offsets that loss. So that's what they're looking for. They're asking the PRPs to develop those projects in phase two. 50% of those restoration projects, the trustees want to take place within the harbor site, and 50% can take place in areas outside of that. And here are two websites if you would like to look at the NRD issues as they develop. NOAA and ODFW both have very comprehensive websites. So that's where we are today legally. Thank you.
That's certainly a sobering note to close the hearing on. I'm almost thinking we should have saved Angus and global warming for last, because that sounded comparatively upbeat after this assessment. Does confidentiality prohibit you from even estimating what the state share of the cleanup and NRDA and orphan costs would be?
Indirectly, yes. Directly, we're developing defenses, so we really haven't gone to the point of hard estimates of those potential liabilities. We are, as I mentioned, working diligently on our defenses. We have expert scientists on board, legal defenses, so at this point, we're not at a juncture to really come up with those estimates.
Okay. Thanks very much. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have a year when the bill is going to come due?
Of course, that's a good question. All timetables that have been offered in the past have kind of been blown through. These allocation processes are supposed to hit the ground at or near the time of the record of decision that EPA publishes. Record of decision sets out, okay, here's the remedy you want. People can then say, okay, how much is that going to cost? Let's split up the pie. That date, is it 2012 or is it going to shift into 2013-14? That's the unknown. These bills will be coming due at or around the time of that record of decision.
Well, thanks very much. Appreciate the members who could stay a half hour past our scheduled end time. Appreciate guests for being here as well. With that, we can close our hearings. I'll close the House Committee on Environment and Water.
And the Senate Environment Committee is adjourned.